A thousand years after the death of Christ, money changers, those who loan out and manipulate the quantity of money, were active in medieval England. In fact, they were so active that acting together, they could manipulate the entire English economy. These were not bankers per se. The money changers generally were the goldsmiths. They were the first bankers because they started keeping other people's gold for safekeeping in their vaults. The first paper money was merely a receipt for gold left at the goldsmith. Paper money caught on because it was more convenient than carrying around a lot of heavy gold and silver coins. Eventually, goldsmiths noticed that only a small fraction of the depositors ever came in and demanded their gold at any one time. Goldsmiths started cheating on the system. They discovered that they could print more money than they had gold, and usually no one would be the wiser. Then they could loan out this extra money and collect interest on it. This was the birth of fractional reserve banking. That is, loaning out many times more money than you have assets on deposit. So, if $1,000 in gold were deposited with them, they could loan out about $10,000 in paper money and draw interest payments on it, and no one would ever discover the deception.
It's Friday. It's just after 5 o'clock, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is, guess who? It's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers once more. Well, in the second hour, momentous U-turn as Huawei are booted out of the UK. In 7 years' time, anyway, in 2027. We ask a former GCHQ officer, since they trusted Huawei equipment themselves, both when he was working there and up until a few days ago. That was the official decision. Huawei equipment is trusted. We ask him if there's any real security risk, or is this just what Britain has to do when we're part of the US empire? Also, after Freemason Kemal Atatürk made the Hagia Sophia Cathedral in Istanbul a museum, Erdogan turns it back, but into a mosque this time, not a Christian church. What's the reaction of Orthodox Christians? And the reason why Russian Orthodox Church has such strong ties to one of the seven wonders of the world. Professor of Slavic culture Vladimir Goldstein explains what Erdogan is up to. And following up from last week's bombshell about the Phoenicians from Lebanon beating Cabot and Columbus to the new world by about 3,000 years, at least very strong evidence for that. More this week, more evidence, in fact, from Lindsay McCauley over in Australia, who sailed on last December's epic voyage in a replica Phoenician galley over to the Caribbean. He explains the Mayan pyramids link up to the Egyptian pyramids and, believe it or not, Solomon's Temple, which Hiram and the Phoenicians built around about 1000 BC. That's Solomon's original temple. It's the giveaway measurement of the cubit. This is the link he's found between all three. Plus, the murder of WPC Yvonne Fletcher by MI6 and the CIA explained in a Dispatches documentary. And then the whole industry of investigative journalism for television and radio and in the newspapers pretty much was shut down. A member of the SAS shares more evidence this week that it was the US and the British, not the Libyans, that killed PC Yvonne Fletcher in St. James's Square in cold blood. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. Well, joining me to review this week's news, though, is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Hi, Martin. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello there, Tony.
Once more, anything you'd like to highlight this week? Any big issues you think have come up in national or local politics? Because one of the things, obviously, to talk about so straight away, really, is the erection of a statue in Bristol on the plinth of Edward Colston, which has made the headlines around the world. Bristol does seem to be the centre of attention for this whole idea of statues and the slave trade.
Yeah, I mean, I picked up on that, as most Bristolians did. The statue has now been removed by the mayor. It's being held, I understand, in one of the museums. And, you know, discussions are going ahead about what's going to happen to the statue and what's going to happen to the plinth on which the statue was erected. I have to say, the positive thing in Bristol, the only really negative thing that's happened is the destruction of Skippy Africanus's grave in Westbury-on-Trim, which is an act of grotesque vandalism by whoever carried that out. But despite all the ripples and waves that have been caused by this around the world, everything in Bristol has been totally peaceful, and there hasn't been any kind of violence of any kind, apart from...
No, it's all been happening at 5 o'clock in the morning, hasn't it?
Yeah. And, you know, it's pretty sickening because the 1720 grave of Scipio Africanus, who was a slave, obviously, and it's the only slave grave that we've got from that era, and somebody saw fit to go and vandalise it. It's supposedly in revenge for the removal of the Colston statue.
Well, I mean, you and I have been talking about this sort of thing for years. One does wonder, doesn't one, straight away, is if this whole thing is being orchestrated as a way to sort of get people banging heads against each other.
Well, it may be so. I mean, I certainly think in the US you've got people fishing in troubled waters, and ultimately, as we saw in the Gladio structures in Western Europe in the 70s and 80s, the idea is to get both far right and far left at each other's throats so that the state can then legitimately, it would appear, get more power to itself.
I mean,
you've got to be very aware of that.
We talked briefly last week about Leah Hunt Hendricks and her oil baron grandfather, who was one of the conspirators to kill President Kennedy. We did talk about, you know, that family. She is, Leah Hunt Hendricks is the heiress of that fortune. You know, actually, the family funding both sides. So this sort of thing does happen, and we can document that. So if you don't believe me, check out Leah Hunt Hendricks, who's one of the main funders of Black Lives Matter, and her family has funded things like the Ku Klux Klan, the John Birch Society, and the far right as well. So this statue, though, is by Mark Quinn. The statue is of a woman called Jen Reed. But if you have a look at actually who is Mark Quinn, you do wonder if he's just not here being quite a smart, if a devious, wealthy artist and just trying to grab a load of publicity, because it's not a typical one of his statues at all, or of his sculptures. A lot of his stuff is extremely sick. When we were talking about basically mutants, he's got an obsession with mutant people who've been dismembered in war. He likes doing statues of them, and people who've been disfigured, say, for example, in the womb and have been mutations, he likes to do statues of them. Plus he drains his blood, his own personal blood, and he likes mixing it with plasters of Paris, and every 2 years he makes a new self-portrait based on his own blood. He's also a great mate of Damien Hirst, so he's not short of a bob or two, this Mark Quinn.
No, and of course the art market is driven by publicity and so on. But of course, you know, artists have always interacted with political movements and vice versa, and no harm was done. And of course, the Marvin made it quite clear that the cost for removing the statue is going to be billed to him. What he and Jen Reed have said is, if the statue is sold, that the money should go to various black charities to encourage.
Well, you know, this is a bit like big corporations, isn't it? Of course, this to him is peanuts compared to the fantastic publicity he's got all around the world.
Well, you could compare him to Banksy, except that Banksy's Bristolian. You know, that's what Banksy's been doing for years, isn't it?
Yeah, but I don't think Banksy does pictures of, like, dismembered war victims and things like that, or does a whole load of kind of sicko portraits in his own blood. I mean, if you go past one of Mark Quinn's artworks, it's more likely to turn your stomach than make you laugh, like Banksy. So I don't really agree with your comparison there.
Well, I mean, you like the one and you don't like the other, but that's your privilege, and that's how people react to art, isn't it?
It's not just a personal thing about me, is it? If you go past a statue of a dismembered person, say covered in human blood, that's not going to really do the same for a person as one of Banksy's humorous little artworks, is it?
Well, I haven't done as much research as you've done on this guy. You've obviously have. I didn't even know what sort of things he did apart from this.
I know. It's,
but it's there you go.
See that the local press and Channel 4 News giving him so much mega publicity when it seems to me very obvious that this is just essentially a publicity stunt. But anyway, look, these sorts of things seem to get carry along despite the remnants of the lockdown still being around. And I just thought it was fascinating that this week there was a protest in Thornbury about the lockdown. Really, it was sparked. There's a woman called Casey Kendall that organised it, and various people from across the country. Around about 100 people attended. She didn't do any publicity for it, even though I sent some messages on to the local media just to say it was taking place. None of them turned up. But I thought I'd have a chat to her about what inspired her to start the protest in the first place. And it turns out that she was just really annoyed to see the pedestrianisation of Thornbury, saying that actually there's friends of hers who run businesses there who are just literally going to have to close down, like takeaways and things like that, because they rely on people being able to drive up, park outside, wait a few minutes and take the stuff away. And she believes that the whole thing was totally unnecessary. As someone who's worked in hospitals and in labs and that sort of thing, and worked with the blood, I don't know exactly what she'll tell us now, what she's worked with. So let's have a listen now to Casey Kendall from Thornbury, who organised the protest last Sunday.
My name's Casey. I've lived in Thornbury for about 2.5 years now. I worked in the Forensic Science Service and I actually used the PCR test. I also worked for 5 years in the NHS as a cytogeneticist. I was studying cells and diagnosing hereditary diseases. So I've got a little bit of lab experience, about 7 years in all.
What's cytogenetics? What's that?
So cyto for cell and genetics for the genetic material. So I was analysing chromosome DNA for hereditary diseases, Down syndrome, Edwards syndrome, Lesson-Kefli, Simony. And that was one of my favourite jobs, actually. The thing that sparked off for me was the closure of our high street and just seeing the residents queuing outside shops, watching what they're doing to the high street and just looking on, not knowing what to do, just a feeling of helplessness. And I didn't think that was right. The speakers were absolutely amazing. They came from all over and we had 5 altogether, and it was better than I could ever have dreamt. I've never organized anything like this before, and I know a little bit about a lot of subjects. So what I wanted to do was just show people, especially the people who live in Thornbury who wanted the high street closed, just the bigger picture. I really wanted to put the bigger picture out there. So I invited 5 speakers who all turned up. It was I was a little bit disappointed with the turnout. I was expecting 100 or more, and we had about 70 at tops. But there were plenty of people who walked by, listened for a little bit, and then walked on. And there were plenty afterwards that were asking for additional information, which is really encouraging. Glastonbury also have problems with our high street, and the information she had was really insightful as to the bigger picture and how it affects local people. So she can, if you look at Agenda 21, you can apply that to every single aspect of life. If you learn about it and go and research about that, then everything that comes up, you will see Agenda 21 in it.
Agenda 21 linked to the lockdown then?
So Agenda 21 is the closure of small businesses. They want to run everything on global businesses. The other thing they want is a cashless society. So we're seeing more and more shops now refusing cash and getting you to pay. Of course, we're all desensitized already to paying by card, and some people are paying by watches. So it's not a big step now to have a microchip implant, which they've been doing in America and other countries since 2015, and just swipe in your hand. This way, they control everything. They control, they can keep an eye on data collection is one of the main things. She said the data collection now is going to be one of the main currencies, is they will keep and sell your data, and you will have a social score. So they'll control, if they don't like what you're doing, they just won't put money onto your chip. And there's no other way. You can't do a little job for cash in hand or anything.
That does sound a bit far-fetched, but this sort of thing is already happening in China, isn't it?
It is. And one of the shops that I went to, and this is another thing I was going to say, the shop I used to go to was run by a couple of Chinese ladies. That's shut down. And there's a few charity shops that have already shut down. because of this. And their parents were coming over from China over Christmas. And when I seen them last, I asked about their parents, and she said they bought their ticket, turned up at the airport, and they were told because of their social score, they weren't allowed to fly because they weren't allowed to leave the country. Here and in Australia, even Chinese students are not allowed to speak out against their government because their parents still live in China and they will get the repercussions. And that is exactly where we're heading for.
Well, I think that's pretty shocking to hear. I mean, we're hearing, aren't we, about the US and the Chinese both in tit for tat, usually led by the US, actually, the US initiative, the Chinese expelling or arresting US business people, diplomats, the same the other way around. But, Martin, we're also hearing, that's the first time certainly I've heard, that ordinary people are being stopped from travelling out of China. They're not allowed to come out by train. They're not allowed, basically, their passport is invalid. They're not allowed to travel. This reminds me a little bit of, you know, the whole situation in the Cold War with Eastern Europe.
Well, that's right. I mean, if you actually think about it, China at one stage had no foreigners living there at all. At the maximum, you know, less than 10 foreigners were allowed into China, and the Chinese people couldn't leave. At the height of the Cultural Revolution, nobody knew what was going on in China, and everybody was basically constantly being observed by the state. So the modern Chinese state, despite its more technological aspect, I mean, they're obviously the kind of mechanisms they now use are much more sophisticated than they used then. But in actual fact, in political terms, it's more liberal than it used to be. That doesn't mean that it's a free society, but you've got to look at these things in historical perspective.
Yeah, but it's closing down again, isn't it? That seems pretty clear. Between America, Europe, Britain and China, relations are breaking down, diplomatic relations, economic relations, and also just this simply freedom of travel too now.
Well, that's right. But you've got to remember that freedom of travel, I mean, Chinese people didn't travel anywhere at one stage. And now, of course, they go all over the place and their students study all over the world. And of course, Trump is now saying he doesn't want Chinese students in the US. Well, that means they'll study in China, which won't do much good for the bottom line of the universities in the US.
Yeah, and one of the things Casey was saying there is that it's basically the fact that their relatives had been in the UK that meant that the other Chinese actually back in China weren't allowed to travel outside. So this is one of the slightly worrying things about, you know, the track and trace and the increased surveillance due to the lockdown, COVID-19, supposedly, whatever, that we could be moving towards a similar situation that we've been so critical of in China with this social credit score.
Well, I think this is what you said earlier. If there was a more cooperative atmosphere at the top, discussions, for example, between the Western powers and the Chinese about their plans for the developing world, the so-called New Silk Road, Belt and Road Initiative, if democratic Russia was included in the discussions and everybody was rubbing along, then we could have a critical discussion about what was not appropriate in terms of social control in the different regions.
But I mean, extra super surveillance due to the lockdown here and start gathering more and more of people's personal data. Surely.
That's been ongoing.
COVID-19
and the lockdown has increased it.
COVID-19 has been used as an excuse, really, to gather people's data in a similar way to the Chinese do.
Yes, and of course we're actually on the brink of World War III. And as we've said on this show week in, week out, it may well be that this is a biological warfare attack, in which case World War III has definitely started. And one of the things that happens in world wars is, yes, you can get bombed, you can get shot, and you also get the state tends to have more control over what people can and can't do. Same in Britain in the Second World War.
Would you compare this then to the phony war in 1939 and 1940?
Well, you could. I mean, what's happened is since the 9/11 attack, which, of course, wasn't carried out by people in caves in Afghanistan, we've become more and more inured to the daily reality that the world is in a massive conflict. And of course, we on one stage, one level, we're encouraged to know that we're in conflict, and we've got to, you know, they're all out to get us, and we've got to give the government more power to make sure they can deal with the threats that we face. And at the same time, we're told just forget about all of that and go shopping, nothing to worry about, life goes on. And of course, it's a massive cognitive dissonance. I mean, since we devastated Iraq in 2003. British people are aware that we're kind of responsible for it, but we've not actually taken responsibility for it. Everybody thinks that we can all just go, well, that was just then. Let's get back to what we want to do. Time for Brexit, time for the football, time to watch the telly. But of course, in Iraq, they've lost a million lives, and on it goes. And there's no end in sight. And that's our fault.
Before we leave the subject of the lockdown, tough new local lockdown powers are in force from tomorrow, says Boris. This is in an announcement earlier today. Prime Minister Boris Johnson has announced tough new local lockdown powers, which will come into force tomorrow, Saturday. Local authorities will be given the power to close cities or parts of cities or even whole counties in case of local flare-ups of the coronavirus. Central government ministers will also be given tough new rules to act fast to contain the virus. Mr. Johnson unveiled the new powers at a press briefing from Downing Street Friday afternoon. He said local authorities will from tomorrow be able to close premises and outdoor public spaces, cancel events and take other actions to contain the virus in their areas. At the same time, government ministers will be able to close entire sectors in an area such as retail or hospitality, order people to stay at home, stop people entering or leaving an area, restrict public transport and restrict the size of gatherings in an area. This will allow for the rapid creation, apparently, of more local lockdowns. Now, it almost sounds to me like the war on terror. Now we've got the war on the virus, Martin.
Well, yes, but it's not just in Britain, is it? Around the world, some countries have done quite well in controlling this virus. Incidentally, they tend to be the communist ones. That's a bit of a clue. And there's other countries which have done rather badly in controlling the virus and are now flailing around attempting to come up with some kind of viable policy. So we're having a general release of lockdown, but in actual fact, not in Leicester and not probably in lots of other places, because in actual fact, we've lost control of the situation here. Whereas in communist China, with all of their social credit and all the rest of it, they've had less than 4,000 deaths.
Well, my point, which is that we're never going to control the virus. The virus is out there. We know it is. It's almost like this could go on for years and years like the war on terror.
Well, it could indeed. What's going to happen is there are going to be clean countries and dirty countries. And the countries like Vietnam, for example, who had 27 deaths, they are basically back to normal, but of course they can't let people in from outside. Yeah. And they're going to be very careful about who they're doing let in from outside. We, on the other hand, have still got a virus that's just being communicated in the community. And we've basically released the lockdown to try and rescue the economy, even though what's kept the economy going is the furlough money. That's going to end at the end of August. And then there's going to be a massive increase in unemployment. And that's just baked into the pie. There's no way around that.
You don't buy any of this, that the lockdown now we're running around about 50 deaths a day, which is minuscule compared to what it was at the peak in April.
We will see, Tony.
You don't buy that at all.
The government may have made the right decision.
It's still a big danger, and everything is still, we need to be prepared like we were in April, that there's no chance to release it, because I mean we've had the release going for 6 weeks or so now, and there certainly hasn't been any massive spike in the cases. It's almost as if, I mean, certainly if you look at the figures, it looks like the pandemic's completely finished.
Well, I think you're being a bit blasé there, but I won't disagree with you. The government have taken these various decisions, and we're going to find out whether they work or not. I'm just comparing us with other countries where they've got no virus at all. And of course, we're not one of those countries, are we? And clearly, we made the bit worse decisions at the beginning. As Chris Whitty said this week, I told them to lock down a week before they did. Now, that's 20,000 people dead who wouldn't be dead if they'd done it a week before, but they didn't. And of course, there's a political price to pay for that as well.
That's
why you've got the government trying to find anybody to blame but themselves.
That's true, though, Martin, is it? Because one of the things you do with a lockdown is you stretch out the problem. Britain has already had loads and loads and loads of this coronavirus everywhere. By having a lockdown, you just kind of stretch out the cases. We haven't been in a situation in Britain probably since maybe November last year where we could have locked down and stopped the virus spreading.
we could have done it. It's becoming pretty clear that when there is a proper investigation, and Boris Johnson in a slippery way admitted that there would be, we'll go back over this, and it will become quite clear that the decision to lock down was taken too late in Britain.
Anyway,
not least because people like Dominic Cummings believed in
But you know, nobody even knew that this was going round Britain in December, January or February.
No, but the decision, it's a time-critical decision at the beginning of lockdown. And other countries went quicker and faster, and they were more prepared.
Other countries didn't have it already circulating, with potentially up to 5 million people having caught it by March.
Listen, this will all come out in the wash, Tony.
We shall see.
It may well be that the government's decisions now to have a limited release of lockdown will not lead to a second surge, and they will be proved to be right. I think they're probably wrong. But
we're also seeing some of these so-called surges are based on tests of people, where they go in, they'll test everybody, and they will say, oh, gosh, we found loads of coronavirus here. But all of those people are actually asymptomatic. So it does seem amazing that they're doing these lockdowns, even though there is very little spreading. One of the things that's come out this week as well is the tests in France and now in Germany, too, have discovered that there's virtually no a coronavirus being spread within schools. So one does wonder why the schools were locked down in the first place. But look, let's look at Bristol itself, because we've got an unelected mayor this year. The elections were cancelled. Marvin Rees is now in charge. And we have a situation with £10 billion black hole in council budget. So let's have a listen to that. It was discussed at Prime Minister's Questions today.
We now head to Yorkshire and visit Nusshah. Nusshah.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Last week, the Chancellor said he could not save every job or business. Councils across England are facing a £10 billion black hole, which could see many issue Section 114 notices, effectively declaring bankruptcy. Many councils are already beginning to make severe layoffs. So I ask the Prime Minister, will the Chancellor save local councils? And does he feel that the support his government has already provided is enough for our most vulnerable communities and will not lead to council cuts and another era of austerity?
Prime Minister.
Yes, indeed, Mr. Speaker. And in Bradford alone, we've allocated £30 million to help deal with the pressures of the virus. And as I said to the House just now, billions, I think 4.2 billion now, in support for local councils across the country. I pay tribute to the work of local councils and their services for helping us to get through this pandemic, and we will continue to support them.
Well, 4.2 billion, that's quite good, but it's not quite the black hole of 10 billion which exists at the moment, Martin, is it?
Well, it's 6 billion short by definition, isn't it? The point is that they don't like local government, and they're not really prepared to recompense them for all the expenditure that they've carried out.
To me, one of the tactics of Boris here, particularly with the big metropolitan Labour areas, is just to bleed them dry of their reserves.
Yeah. That's basically what they're going to do. You can be sure of that. And, of course, that means that the people who live in the most deprived inner city areas are the people who are going to take the most pain as a result of what's happened. And this is always the way, isn't it?
They're like buses. We haven't heard anything from our MPs for God knows how long now. I mean, I listen through the Prime Minister's questions almost every week, and we haven't heard anything from the Bristol MPs for ages. But guess what? Two come along at once this week. On Wednesday, let's start with the Filton and Bradley Stokes Conservative MP, Jack Lopresti, who's talking about jobs, particularly in aerospace in Bristol this week.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. In my constituency of Filton and Bradley Stoke, there are well over 20,000 people directly employed in the aerospace and defence sectors, as well as 17,500 people in the supply chain throughout the South West region. Now, these jobs are not only vital to the individuals and families supported by them, but they are crucial to the economy of our region and our country at large, our future export prospects, connectivity and our sovereign defence manufacturing capability with programmes like Tempest, the next generation of fighter aircraft. So when will the Prime Minister announce a wide-ranging support package for the aerospace industry, which must include a scrappage scheme for old and highly polluting aircraft?
Minister.
And
Minister, come on.
We've got to move on, Mr. Speaker. I'll examine the idea of a scrappage scheme for old and highly polluting aircraft. But what I can tell him is that long before then, we're putting $3.9 billion into the Aerospace Technology Institute. And as I'm sure he knows, the Department of Business, Enterprise and Skills has set up with Transport a joint task force to create Jet Zero, a zero emissions passenger plane in which this country will lead the world.
Okay, zero emissions passenger plane. And Jack Lopressi's cut rather short there. Look, aerospace, Filton, it seems as if it's going down the tubes, Martin.
Well, yeah, and of course, what's actually happening is that the Conservatives have just been converted to the idea of state intervention. What happened to the market? And of course, the market can't function. So the state is going to have to guess what the market's going to look like in a wee while and invest appropriately. Of course, the state isn't prepared to do that because it's not geared up for it. They just presumed the market was going to decide. And the same things, of course, has happened with the nationalisation of railways. Loads and loads of companies at every level of the economy are now dependent on the state. It's like a communist country, isn't it? Except it isn't. Because they haven't got a philosophy that underpins that. They don't know why they're doing it. They're doing it because they've got to do it. But they don't know what they're going to do at the end of it. And, of course, there's no real vision there.
Anyway, look, back to local lockdowns now, because that's the big thing now. You know, there's been a lot of people calling for a bit more autonomy to local areas, local health boards and this sort of thing. But I'm not sure if I was very comfortable with the idea of our mayor, Marvin Rees, deciding if anyone is allowed to move in Bristol or not. Particularly when the southwest has been incredibly low on the national figures, it might just be that he uses these powers in an arbitrary way. And many people have accused him of being a dictator, as any mayor who's elected to that sort of power is able to be basically a dictator. And also, of course, reminding our listeners that he wasn't elected, as many other mayors who were supposed to be elected this year. I mean, it might well be that people of Bristol voted him out, but he's still sitting there, increasing his pay by 12.5%. and running the city, supposedly. Anyway, so let's have a listen now to another local MP, Darren Jones from Bristol, Bristol North West, talking about these local lockdowns.
Darren Jones, Prime Minister, Mr. Speaker, on the 23rd of June and again on the 24th of June, the Prime Minister said to the House in respect of financial support for businesses and workers during local lockdowns that nobody should be penalised for doing the right thing. Last week, the Secretary of State for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy was unable to give any details to my committee at all about this vital future local support. So can the Prime Minister today be crystal clear for the towns and cities preparing for local lockdowns? Will he be penalising businesses and workers for doing the right thing or not?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, we've given, in addition to the £160 billion of support that the government has given to people and firms across the country, we've supported areas, cities in lockdown with considerable grants, so £20 million to Leicester, business rates relief for £44 million, £68 million in business, on spending on business grants. The best thing possible is for them all to work hard, as Blackburn and Darwin have done, for instance, to get the virus down and to make sure that they're able to open up again.
So we haven't actually had to work very hard, have we? Because we it seems to me, Martin, I don't know whether you agree, that we actually had a high incidence of this COVID-19 in 2019 and in January and February in the southwest. Certainly, I mean, I remember reporting friends of mine at the BBC saying that the Natural History Unit in the 17th of December had a wave of it, several people off work, spreading it around at the BBC. But, of course, the BBC themselves have not reported that fact. We are now in the situation where these local lockdowns could be sort of happening at any time if the local authorities can actually even afford to do them. So Darren is actually raising some quite important issues there about these new powers.
Well, and of course, you got the same response from Bojo as you got earlier, which is he just gives a list of the money that they're making available. But of course, that money doesn't necessarily cover all the losses of a lockdown. And this is where this is one of the problems with having local lockdowns. You see the same problem in the US. Each local state and each local area has got a different policy.
It
makes it very difficult for people to know whether they're coming or going, doesn't it?
Yes, exactly. So, you know, you may cross the road and find yourself arrested because there's something else going on in a different part of the town. Anyway, the police are definitely not happy with this, and we'll be talking about that in a minute. But the one of the things we talked about, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, was this bizarre side issue to the whole COVID-19 pandemic, which is our medical records being handed over by statute to the National Security Agency in the United States and GCHQ here in Britain. All of our medical history, which is supposed to be private, is just supposed to be ours, now it's theirs. Well, something even more sinister is going on, and that is now all being handed on to our local authorities. So Marvin Rees can go through my medical records if he wants to, and so can other officials at Bristol City Council. Let's have a listen now to the talk show host, Richie Allen, who does a weekly radio, well, actually daily radio show pretty much, which I appear on from time to time, pointing this out.
Local authorities have been demanding, through people like the Shadow Health Secretary, Jonathan Ashworth, they've been demanding, I've been covering this the last few days, it's a bit sinister, this. They want people's data, they want their medical data, to better effectively trace people, to avoid more localised lockdowns. And in the House of Commons the other day, Matt Hancock effectively told Jonathan Ashworth that local councils are getting that data. They are getting personal identifiable data to help them follow people that have maybe tested positive and been told to stay at home so that they can follow up on those people. This really is 1984 now, and I don't say that for effect, I don't say it to be dramatic, but I think it's gotten as bad as it's going to get, and then day by day something else happens that isn't challenged, that isn't opposed by any politician really in the country of any note. And I think, where are we going to be next year? Well, we know, of course, that masks will be introduced in shops in the UK, in England, I should say, by next week, by next Friday, tomorrow week. And I fear, personally, none of that is going to change until they mass produce a vaccine. And I really believe when that happens, that those of us who don't partake in the vaccine will be told that we will be subject to our own personal lockdown of sorts. In other words, well, that's okay, Mr. Adam, but you'll kind of have to hang around your home or as near to it as best you can.
So that's Richie Allen there speaking yesterday. But Martin, this is a bit of a worry, isn't it? I mean, it just seems we've completely lost control of our personal private data. It's just slid away, and now it's being handed over to local authorities too, and goodness knows where else. I mean, we do know actually that the intelligence services, once they've got it, that there is actually quite a lot of evidence that they then sell it on to big corporations. In fact, there's been a big drive from central government to get more of the big transnational corporations to cooperate and work very closely with the intelligence services too.
Well, yes, and Dominic Cummings, of course, is very keen on the idea that these AI companies, like the ones set up by Peter Thiel, should have access to NHS data. And in fact, they've been given it. And this is, you know, if you give your data to the NHS, that's a government thing. It's supposedly got checks and balances in it. We all know what's supposed to be going on. It's a public body. But these private companies, AI companies, have been given access to all the data, and they say that they're not going to use it. They're not going to abuse that. But of course they are, and of course they're linked to the intelligence services. A lot of the intelligence services work is in fact subcontracted to these various AI companies. It's very sinister. And the COVID-19 crisis has brought it forward.
I mean, it looks to me as if the pandemic is being used as an excuse for the rich and powerful, particularly corporate power and the banksters, to get away with a whole load of stuff that they wanted to do anyway.
Well, it's what Naomi Klein called disaster capitalism, isn't it? Never let a good crisis go to waste. They wanted to go in these kind of directions anyway, and this gives them the carte blanche to do it. And, of course, the problem is that there is some legitimate reason to collate this kind of data when you're dealing with something like this. But, of course, we don't trust the pharmaceutical companies, the intelligence services, or the government to manage this effectively, or you know, they're not to be trusted with it. Who is going to guard the guardians?
Yeah, a bit annoying for Jonathan Ashworth to be pushing for this, but anyhow, let's have a listen now to Keir Starmer at Prime Minister's Questions, where he was starting to look ahead a little bit and at this autumn and this winter with the way that the lockdown is going to be eased and the potential for problems to come.
Keir Starmer.
The Prime Minister knows exactly what I'm talking about. It's the rehiring 30,000 people at BA on worse terms and conditions, and he should call it out. Yesterday, the government's expert advisory group published a report on the challenges this autumn and winter. They were asked to do so by the government's Office for Science. That report assessed the reasonable worst-case scenario for this autumn and winter, including a second COVID spike and seasonal flu, and it set out strong recommended actions to mitigate the risks. The report was clear: July and August must be a period of intense preparation, i.e. now. Can the Prime Minister make clear that he intends to implement the recommended actions in this report in full and at speed?
Prime Minister, not only are we getting on with implementing the preparations for a potential new spike, but he will know that the government is engaged in record investments in the NHS, £34 billion. What I think the House may not realise is just in the last year since this government has been in office, there are now 12,000 more nurses in the NHS, 6,000 more doctors, and it was thanks to their hard work, thanks to the hard work of the entire NHS, that we were able to prevent our health service from being overwhelmed this spring, and we will take steps to ensure that it is not overwhelmed this winter as well.
Starmer. That's the whole point of this report.
Exactly.
It sets out the reasonable worst case scenario and tells the government what it needs to do about it. So I'm surprised he's not committing to fully implement it.
Well, I'm not surprised. Old Boris is so full of bluster, Martin, isn't he?
Well, he is. And, you know, we could talk about the pandemic and what needs to be done. But more, you know, it's probably more constructive to talk about the politics around all of this.
Well, yeah, but why is Starmer telling Boris that you must cater for the worst case scenario? Well, we tried to do that with the massive initial lockdown and the putting up all these hospitals that were never used and that sort of thing. It seems quite obvious to me that you shouldn't be catering for the worst case scenario. You should be catering for the most likely scenario.
Well, you may say that. Starmer is trying to kebab him, saying, will you fulfil the report, the recommendations in this report? We didn't actually hear what they were. So it's hard to come to a conclusion.
I'm sure what he's suggesting is that we need to have very harsh lockdown measures in order to stop a second spike. But
well, I don't know that that's what that report says, but it may or may not.
The thing that they're pushing effectively is just saying, oh, you know, the economy can go hang. We need to just make sure we don't get a second spike. But that could be a form of paranoia.
Well, it could be. But the real problem, Tony, is that the economy is stuffed anyway. If COVID disappeared tomorrow morning, the economy would still be stuffed.
The only way to sort this out, really, is going to be with government control of the Bank of England, surely, making sure that the
government does control the Bank of England. In theory, it's an independent central bank, but it's not a private bank like the Federal Reserve. And there's a very interesting article this week in the New Statesman about the response of the Bank of England and the Treasury to the crisis. And of course, Andrew Bailey just came into his job the week the crisis broke, and they've obviously briefed the reporter who wrote the article. I can't remember the name of him. It's a long, in-depth article involving lots of interviews with Andrew Bailey and other financial civil servants.
I just think we should put a link up to that on our show page at this
week. It's in the New Statesman. You can read one article in the New Statesman every month without paying. So if that's the one to read, read that one, because it's quite a long article. And they are very, very scathing about the government's response, very scathing about Dominic Cummings. And in fact, they're being pretty hostile. And that's probably because they feel that the Treasury and the Bank of England have got sufficient clout to face him down.
Maybe there'd be an equivalent article in The Spectator saying the opposite.
Well, the point is that the Bank of England staff have clearly decided that they're going to brief this guy from the New Statesman. And they're on the record as saying all sorts of things.
Look, hang on a minute, because a lot of those people will be a bit like Corbyn, having to suffer in the Labour Party with all the people Blair appointed. They will be Carney appointees, won't they, a lot of them?
Well, they're basically career civil servants, and they've worked in that field.
I mean,
they're not at all.
Oh. Isn't there a purge of the civil service going on at the moment?
Well, that's right. And, of course, what they are doing, the rest of the civil service, Mark Sedwill, who's the head of the civil service, he's been thrown out the window by Cummings, who himself should have been thrown out the window, if you remember. He only escaped his own job by the skin of his teeth, but he's now raging around like Genghis Khan, getting rid of people who've been there for years.
He can't do that
in the Bank of England.
Surely what's happening here is exactly what should have happened when Jeremy Corbyn took over the Labour Party. Is that you've got a new government under Boris and they are fed up with all these very biased civil servants that were appointed by Cameron and Theresa May as basically a completely different new generation coming in now.
Well, you've got to recognise, Tony, that in the US, when anybody wins an election, even at local level, for parish level, any level, then they sack everybody that was previously employed and they bring all their own people in. We've never done it like that in this country. We have a professional civil service which serves, which means that you've got continuity. Can you imagine the chaos if every time we had an election in Bristol, everybody that was employed by the council was sacked and a whole load of new people were brought in?
You can
do it like that, but it's a way to do it.
That is exactly what happened when Marvin Rees turned up at the council. He got rid of all of the senior people, all their experience and local knowledge, and brought in a load of pro-corporate types.
Well, this is a constant battle at any level of politics. Are you going to have permanent people? I mean, for example, British ambassadors in the Foreign Office are professional diplomats. They have a career path and all the rest of it. US ambassadors are basically big funders of whoever the political party in charge is, and they get a job to go and represent Britain, US in Germany or wherever. But they've got no diplomatic skills at all. They just go around there and basically they often insult the locals and create all kinds of problems.
Anyway, but
that doesn't happen in the British Foreign
Office. Apparently coming in 10 days or so's time. Everyone's got to wear a mask. It doesn't matter. You can have a swastika on your mask if you want to. You're allowed to do that in this country. Whether or not it's actually good for you is another question. There's lots of reports out there, in fact, some from the World Health Organization themselves, that say that the masks are really a bad idea if you've got certain conditions, and even if you haven't, that they actually reduce your oxygen content, and others saying that effectively what they do is when you've got a mask on, you tend to touch it more, and therefore you're bringing potential contamination up to your face because you're wearing a mask. But anyway, there's all sorts of contention about whether this is an enforceable rule or not. So let's have a listen now to the Metropolitan Police Federation Chair, Ken Marsh, talking on the Today programme on Tuesday morning.
Ken Marsh, Chair of the Metropolitan Police Federation. Good morning, Mr. Marsh.
Good morning.
How enforceable do you think this is going to be for your officers? Because you'll have heard Peter Cowgill saying there, this is not a matter for shop security, it's a matter for the police.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's two strands to what you've just said. Firstly, shopkeepers need to step up to the plate and take some responsibility. They can quite easily put signs up on their doors, no mask on, no entry, this is private property. That's the first point that, you know, we need to get across, because this cannot all be laid on the shoulders of the police yet again. The second point is it will be nigh on impossible for enforcement, because you won't have a police officer on every shop door, because there isn't enough of us. If a shopkeeper calls the police because someone hasn't got a mask on, they have no power to detain them, so that person can just walk away. We'll be driving round and round London looking for people who weren't wearing masks. It's absolutely absurd.
But most people are compliant, aren't they? That's certainly the evidence from transport in London, that there's about 90% compliance.
I would question the 90% compliance on public transport, having been on it and seen myself what's taking place. But you're quite right. A huge amount of the British public are completely compliant. But there are a lot of people who are just not interested, do not want to wear one, and will become very cantankerous when they are told to do so.
And they will then, that will place your officers in a difficult position?
Absolutely. It's It's a more than a difficult position. It becomes a position where it is them and us yet again. And we've seen this throughout this COVID pandemic. It has always become the police's problem to deal with this.
That's because it's the police's job to enforce the law and regulations.
Not on private property. If someone's not doing what someone privately owns their property for, it isn't the police's problem to deal with it. I think you'll find under legislation. But, you know, the issue here is, how do we deal with this collectively rather than making it just the police's problem to deal with? And the legislation that's come out has laid it fully on the police's shoulder. And as I said to you at the beginning, shopkeepers can take some responsibility by signage, etc., to explain.
So that's Ken Marsh, Chair of the Metropolitan Police Federation, Martin. I mean, it seems like a bit of ping-pong, really. The shopkeeper's saying it's the police's job. The police are saying, well, that's absurd. We can't be everywhere at once.
Yeah, well, you can see there are no good options in these kind of circumstances. In some cultures, the wearing of masks, for example, in Hong Kong, because they've had SARS and all these other outbreaks, people wear masks, they just do it. In some cultures, it's just not, you know, you can see there's a split within the British population where I live around here. So some people are wearing masks, certainly most of the shopkeepers are, but lots of people aren't. If it's compulsory, I've got one, I will wear it if it's required. We just, you know, people rowing and arguing about this are not helping themselves or anybody else, really.
But he's saying it's absurd.
He's saying that the police can't be made responsible for policing it. That's a perfectly legitimate point of view coming from his point of view. If we were going, what the question has to be is, if we're going to be wearing masks from next Friday, why weren't we doing it already? And of course, that's the trouble with the response of the government from the very beginning.
Yeah,
herd immunity.
Especially since the figures suggest that the pandemic is over, and also that the vast majority of people, we're talking about at least 70-80% of people, aren't actually that vulnerable to this anyway. And it's surely up to people to take their own responsibility. Anyway, this will be very interesting to see how this all plays out, the mask business. And I suggest that, I mean, you know, the BBC have been talking about, 40% of people wear masks. Well, when I was in Gloucester at the weekend, it was interesting to watch, to look around. I spent 3 hours hobbling around Gloucester. I didn't see a single person wearing a mask. So I would say that...
You're not supposed to wear them outdoors anyway.
Is it around about
1%? That would be the explanation, wouldn't it?
1%.
You're not supposed to wear them when you're in a shop or you're on public transport.
Yeah, but this is even in the shopping centres and things like that.
Well, they don't have to wear them in the shopping centres, from Friday next they will.
Not a single person did I see, and yet the BBC are reporting 40% of people in public spaces are wearing masks. It's just not true. As Ken Marsh is saying, you know, there's the BBC saying 90% of people on buses. He's saying that's not what he's seen. So we're seeing a lot of misreporting as well. But anyway, I thought it would be useful to have a listen to, I think, a marvellous old doctor. His name's Vernon Coleman. He's been doing a whole series of recordings on the effects of this pandemic. I first came across him, gosh, must be about 1996, as a book that he'd written called How to Stop Your Doctor Killing You. And he was a doctor who was extremely sceptical, like Andrew Wakefield, for example, about the pharmaceutical industry, saying, well, look, this is a predatory industry. They're actually trying to make people sick so that they can get them dependent on their products and satisfy their shareholders. So let's have a listen now to Vernon Coleman now. His idea, of course, is, and most doctors should be, to do no harm. But he says, actually, that they're now starting to get into a mode where elderly people begin to be expendable.
How have we managed to forget that in the 1930s, the Nazis deliberately starved and dehydrated elderly and vulnerable patients because they were regarded as a useless burden on society? That's exactly what we're doing today. We're killing people off if they're old and can't complete an Ironman triathlon. The government has already given doctors the legal right to kill old people by starving them to death or depriving them of fluids if they're filling a hospital bed that the administrators want to use for a patient requiring cosmetic surgery or infertility treatment. So what's the next step? Well, the next obvious step is to kill off all sorts of patients with chronic or potentially expensive illnesses such as cancer and heart disease. How on earth could you do that? How could the politicians possibly get the voters to put up with that? Well, you could shut down the hospitals on the excuse that they're needed for the 8 million patients expected to fall ill with the coronavirus. It would be like introducing the death penalty by the back door. But we won't be killing the possibly guilty, we'll be killing the definitely innocent. You couldn't do that, of course, though, could you? Of course you could. And they have. In the UK, there'll be soon 10 million people awaiting hospital appointments and treatment. Nearly 2.5 million are currently waiting for treatment for cancer. Hospital departments are still shut because of social distancing, although there's absolutely no reason at all for it. We don't shut hospitals when there's a flu epidemic. And let me remind you, this is not as bad as a flu epidemic. What if it was all part of a plan to get rid of people who need treatment? What would you call it when a government decides to kill millions of patients who might need care and cost money? Genocide, perhaps? Is it part of the complete reset of our world, as talked about and enthused over by Prince Charles and company at the World Economic Forum? Why have things changed so much? Well, it's partly money, and it's partly eugenics. Bill Gates used to be very keen on eugenics, so I hear. It's all part of a wider plan.
So that's Dr. Vernon Coleman. He hasn't been thrown out by the General Medical Council yet, the author of the book, How to Stop Your Doctor Killing You. I find his talks quite refreshing, Martin. We're certainly not going to be hearing him on the BBC. But he's saying, well, actually, you know, the effect of this, there's millions of people who are simply not getting treatment on the NHS at the moment. This is like a giant cull.
Yeah, but of course he's then going on to say this is a plan. Now, it may be a plan, but whose plan is it? If it's a plan, Steve Bannon and others think it's a Chinese biowarfare attack on the West. I don't think it's a Chinese biowarfare attack on the West. I think it's a Western biowarfare attack on China, which has the secondary effect of killing off loads of old people, as he says. And of course, ultimately, that could be the eugenicist agenda behind all of this. And what are we going to do about it? Well, the point is denying that there is anything such, you know, that the pandemic is a physical reality. It's not just in the mind. And of course, this you've got to start really talking about psychological warfare, World War III, and all the rest.
You're saying in the present tense, the pandemic is a reality. I think you know, we could be talking about this all night, Martin. But I'm going to put on our show page at thisweek.org.uk those NHS figures again. When you look at the graph, I mean, it's basically banged down against the axis again. It's been right up high, but now we're banging against the axis. But look, I don't want to labour that point, but I will put that up on the show page at thisweek.org.uk. I think it would be useful, I think, to have a listen to a general analysis of this whole idea about vaccines, because this seems to be the direction that we're heading. And this is a talk. It's basically a meeting that Del Bigtree, he's the director of the film Vaxxed, which, if you remember, we had an extract a couple of years ago when it first came out. And there's been all sorts of attempts to stop this film being shown. And it's largely features Andrew Wakefield, the so-called discredited Andrew Wakefield, talking about the dangers of the modern vaccination industry. Now, I just want to stress that he's not against all vaccines. None of them are. But he's saying that the vaccine industry is turning into a giant monster that wants to inject us with any old rubbish in order to make money. So let's have a listen now to Del Bigtree in a pre-COVID speech about vaccines.
People need to know. Yeah. Not a single childhood vaccine has ever been tested against an inert placebo. They never admitted that until we challenged them on it. In that meeting, we said we cannot find any double-blind inert placebo study for a single one of the 16 childhood vaccines that we give our children. Are they not being done, or are you not showing them? Are we looking at the wrong websites? Because we've read every single scientific piece of information from our government and from the manufacturers. At first, one of the scientists said, oh, we do double-blind experiments. They're just in early trial phases. And we said, fine, we're sitting at the National Institute of Health. Please bring those in right now because they would be here. They couldn't provide that. And then Tony Fauci, head of infectious disease, said, we don't do double-blind experiments with placebos because it would be unethical. So our medical establishment has decided that it's unethical to have a placebo group, and therefore not a single childhood vaccine has ever established a safety control. We don't know if they're safe. There's no way to say they're safe. Essentially, we've decided in this country and around the world that it's more ethical to give a product that's never been through a safety study to every child in the country. Now what they'll say is, well, we've been running it for a very long time, and it's proven to be safe. Well, really, we have the sickest generation of children this country has ever seen. We have seen the largest decline in public health in history. We have gone from 12.8% chronic illness, so neurological or autoimmune diseases in the 1980s, before we took liability away, when we were getting 10 vaccines. Then we took liability away from the industry. They could no longer be sued if their products injured anyone. And now, in 2019, we're giving 72 vaccines, and our chronic illness rate in our children is 54%. We've gone from 12 to 54% chronic illness. That means neurological disorders in 1 in 6 of our children. 1 in 7 has a speech delay. 1 in 4 is leaving elementary school on a drug they're going to be on the rest of their lives. The point being, this is the greatest crash in public health we've ever seen. We have more babies dying on the first day of life than every other industrialized nation combined. These are all facts. I can back them up. I'll show a lot of them are cited here. We have more babies dying in the first year of life than the 20 other richest nations in the world. And we're now reporting we're 70% more likely to die before reaching 18 in America than the 20 other richest nations. What is the reason for this? Well, there's two things that I think people say, well, you're saying vaccines are doing all of that. We now have science that's happening all over the world that's showing how vaccines are definitely contributing to the problem. But here's the point. Should we be listening to health departments? Should we be making laws based on recommendations from a health department that has overseen the greatest decline in public health in world history? I think that we really need to look twice. And I would urge any politician to say, I want to see the science from the other side. They keep saying there's thousands of studies that show that vaccines don't cause autism. We've read them. They're not there. Those science studies do not exist. They are not there. There are 14 total studies looking at autism, and half of them are on the MMR vaccine and the other on thimerosal. When they say vaccines, plural, do not cause autism, they have only looked at one vaccine out of 16 vaccines. Most parents are complaining that the DTaP vaccine causes autism, and the Institute of Medicine looked into it, and you know what they found? Not a single study has ever looked at the comparison of autism and the DTaP vaccine. They said, we can neither confirm nor deny whether the DTaP vaccine causes autism, and that's what's cited by the CDC. That study is what they cite when they say vaccines, plural, do not cause autism. That's a fraud. That's a fraud being perpetrated by the CDC. And so the warning that I would be giving from your team to everyone else is, you can be the first Nazi in, and throughout history, when we start book burning, when we start censoring speech, when we start using bullying tactics to move society instead of information and science, we know we're coming to our end. And we don't want to see the government fail. We do not want to see oppression. And by the way, this oppression, laws like this, taking away this exemption, is making our movement explode. Mm-hmm. It is exploding. Mm-hmm. And measles is exploding, because what would you do if you were told you were going to be quarantined from being able to be in a synagogue on Passover? You'd say, let's go ahead and get the measles out of the way right now so that we can never be quarantined again. They are causing what they call an epidemic. How do you call something an epidemic when everyone in it is trying to get the measles? That's what's happening in England. Right. No one's running from it. This is not Ebola.
No, 5,000.
Right. You have to go get your vaccine this week. You're going to say, hold on a second, I've been healthy for 15 years without a vaccine, and so is every adult in this country. So they're going to remove the exemptions before they bring the adult mandate. The pharmaceutical industry isn't the number one most powerful lobby in Washington, outspending oil and gas simply because they want to waste time in Washington. They have one product, the vaccine industry, that cannot be sued, doesn't have to go through safety studies, so there's no cost on this product. There's no risk on this product. We have 72 vaccines now, 270 have been approved, and thousands are in trials as we speak. The future of this industry is vaccines, and every politician they can buy to force more vaccines into the population, they're going to make money. But the moment the adult mandate comes, I assure you, pharma's not fighting for the 2% of the unvaccinated kids. They want 320, 40 million Americans, wherever we're at right now, indentured to a program That will turn the pharmaceutical industry from a billion-dollar industry, $50 billion they're making from vaccines right now, into a trillion-dollar industry overnight. That is what is taking place, yeah. And it is people like you and great politicians that are protecting us right now, yeah. As they should, from one of the most dangerous industries that has paid out over $30 billion in damages for having killed us with products they knew were dangerous.
So that's the director of Vaxxed, Dale Bigtree, there, speaking before the lockdown, actually, about vaccines. But Martin, he's painting a pretty scary picture there of the biggest lobby in Washington having completely captured and controlled regulation of their own industry to the extent where the Center for Disease Control is using expressions like, we neither confirm nor deny whether this vaccine is safe.
Yeah, well, I mean, the pharmaceutical industry is clearly, not on the side of the angels and never has been. Ivan Illich, the social thinker, wrote a book which came out in 1964, I think, called Medical Nemesis. And, of course, the underlying all of this is that it's all done for private profit. It isn't done for private profit in countries like Cuba.
Also, I mean, he mentioned there, didn't he? Dale mentioned this whole thing of people not being able to sue a vaccine company if they're damaged by a vaccine. Now, of course, this takes on a much more sinister aspect if you're forced to have their vaccine. And then if it damages you, kills one of your loved ones, you can't sue. Suddenly it all becomes very, very nasty. And this started back in the 1980s. That's when the pharmaceutical industry managed to get this law through in the US. You couldn't sue the pharmaceutical industry. That actually, it would be the US government you would have to sue. And, of course, the government are not going to find against themselves, are they? Let's have a listen now to this extract from the 60 Minutes documentary, which was done in 1976, just after the swine flu epidemic, looking at the effects that the vaccines for the swine flu had had on people, which are pretty horrific. And also, Martin, as you might not be entirely surprised, the breakout of swine flu in the 70s started with the military.
Yeah, just as the 1918 Spanish flu began on a military base in Kansas.
Fascinating.
Probably as a result of vaccinations.
Extract from the 60 Minutes documentary now.
Remember the swine flu scare of 1976? That was the year the U.S. government told us all that swine flu could turn out to be a killer that could spread across the nation. And Washington decided that every man, woman, and child in the nation should get a shot to prevent a nationwide outbreak, a pandemic. Well, 46 million of us obediently took the shot. And now 4,000 Americans are claiming damages from Uncle Sam amounting to $3.5 billion because of what happened when they took that shot. By far the greatest number of the claims, two-thirds of them, are for neurological damage or even death, allegedly triggered by the flu shot. We pick up the story back in 1976 when the threat posed by the swine flu virus seemed very real indeed.
This virus was the cause of a pandemic in 1918 and 1919 that resulted in over 500,000 deaths in the United States, as well as 20 million deaths around the world.
See how easy it is to...
Thus, the U.S. government's publicity machine was cranked into action to urge all America to protect itself against the swine flu menace.
Influenza is serious business. During major flu epidemics, millions of people are sick and thousands die. Well, this year you can get protection. The vaccines are safe, easy to take, and they can protect you against flu. So roll up your sleeve. Protect yourself.
One of those who did roll up her sleeve was Judy Roberts. She was perfectly healthy, an active woman, when in November of 1976, she took her shot. 2 weeks later, she says, she began to feel a numbness starting up her legs.
I joked about it at that time. I said, I'll be numb to the knees by Friday if this keeps up. By the following week, I was totally paralyzed.
So completely paralyzed, in fact, that they had to operate on her to enable her to breathe. And for 6 months, Judy Roberts was a quadriplegic. The diagnosis? A neurological disorder called Guillain-Barré syndrome, GBS for short. These neurological diseases are little understood. They affect people in different ways. As you can see in these home movies taken by a friend, Judy Roberts' paralysis confined her mostly to a wheelchair for over a year. but this disease can even kill. Indeed, there are 300 claims now pending from the families of GBS victims who died, allegedly as a result of the swine flu shot. In other GBS victims, the crippling effects diminish and all but disappear. But for Judy Roberts, progress back to good health has been painful and partial.
Now, I notice that your smile, Judy, is a little bit constricted.
Yes, it is.
Is it different from what it used to be?
Very different. I have a greatly decreased mobility in my lips. And I can't drink through a straw on the right-hand side. I can't blow out birthday candles. I don't whistle anymore, for which my husband is grateful.
It may be a little difficult for you to answer this question, but have you recovered as much as you are going to recover?
Yes. This is it.
So you will now have a legacy of braces on your legs for the rest of your life?
Yes. The weakness in my hands will stay, and the leg braces will stay.
So Judy Roberts and her husband have filed a claim against the U.S. government. They're asking $12 million, though they don't expect to get nearly that much.
Judy, why did you take the flu shot?
I'd never taken any other flu shots, but I felt like this was going to be a major epidemic. And the only way to prevent a major epidemic of a really deadly variety of flu was for everybody to be immunized.
Where did this so-called deadly variety of flu, where did it first hit back in 1976? It began right here at Fort Dix in New Jersey in January of that year when a number of recruits began to complain of respiratory ailments, something like the common cold. An Army doctor here sent samples of their throat cultures to the New Jersey Public Health Lab to find out just what kind of bug was going around here. One of those samples was from a Private David Lewis who had left his sickbed to go on a forced march. Private Lewis had collapsed on that march, and his sergeant had revived him by mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. A few days later, Private Lewis died.
So, again, Martin, the military being the source of that outbreak in the United States, it's starting to get a bit of a regular pattern, this, isn't it?
Yeah, well, as you know, the sort of alternative history of the 1918 epidemic was that it began on a military base in Kansas, and they'd all just been inoculated against flu before they went off to the Western Front. Wilson, who was the president at the time, was told what was going on, but they didn't tell anybody what was happening because they didn't want to upset the war effort. And the reporting of it only came out in Spain because Spain wasn't involved in the First World War and were therefore didn't have military censorship. And so, ultimately they treated it as if it was an accidental outbreak, but they kept it quiet anyway. And of course, the suspicion is that it was accidental. I don't think they deliberately intended to set off the outbreak, but they were using vaccines and they were cutting corners because it's wartime and we've got to get the boys into the trenches as quick as possible. The vaccine's going to help. Similarly, in the run-up to the first Gulf War, loads of injections for the soldiers involved, which had devastating consequences.
Absolutely, that's Gulf War syndrome for you. Yeah, so, I mean, the other thing is that using the wartime censorship to cover up the source of the actual Spanish flu, very convenient.
Yeah, and I think there is an interaction between militarization, authoritarianism, big pharma. But it's probably a more complex relationship than a straightforward plot.
I mean, you've
just got the interaction of all these negative forces.
I was hearing basically there's two new buildings just being built at Port and Down, so obviously expansion of their activities, even though they're not supposed to exist. So is it possible that that they've been involved somehow in creating this virus?
Well, we're coming to the nitty-gritty here. Whether the Wuhan virus, as the right wing in the US and Australia have taken to calling it, whether it started in Wuhan, B, whether it's just a virus like other viruses, or whether it came from this particular research center. But of course, they were doing work for DARPA, which is the Dominic Cummings is very keen on DARPA, and they were both in the West and in the East. They've been looking at bat coronaviruses. Now they're looking at them because they may become a threat, you know, just because they're out there in the environment, or because somebody may weaponize them. Now, I don't know whether this is a weaponized virus or not. We've discussed this week in, week out.
It's a famous Nature magazine article from the end of last year, which is calling them out, what they're up to, saying, well, actually, what you're trying to do is you're trying to see if you can get bat coronaviruses and other animal ones to jump to humans. And this is completely ridiculous and unnecessary research. You've got to stop it immediately.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are scores, if not hundreds, of labs doing this kind of work. They're funded by DARPA. They're funded by the Pentagon. They're not funded by the health department. So they're definitely weaponizing viruses and looking at what they can do with them. And we know that they've used these kind of biological weapons against Cuba and against Eastern Europe and against North Korea. The Colorado beetle was dropped all over them to kill off their potatoes. They've been looking into this ever since the end of the Second World War. And this could very well be what we're going through is the ultimate what ultimately happens.
Well,
when people pursue these
important down, which I think personally it might well be. The government committee that will be looking into it is the Intelligence and Security Committee. Not that they actually really delve too deep. They seem to be a little bit afraid to do that. We've had a bit of a debacle this week, haven't we, with Chris Grayling having lost his race to be chair of the Intelligence and Security Committee, having been being taken over by Tory Julian Lewis. Instead, he's managed to sort of scupper Boris's plans to put Grayling in charge. With a bit of help from Labour.
Yeah, and I was talking about this on RT yesterday. Yes, and it's quite interesting. I mean, Grayling is regarded as one of the least competent cabinet ministers ever. And the idea of putting him in charge of the security committee, where he's got no background in that whatsoever, I think what his job was to do was
that's
to...
perfect. Martin, that's perfect
well,
for the...
Well, of course, yes, absolutely. In a way, that's absolutely perfect. And what his job was to do, there's apparently this report on Russian interference in British politics, which has been under wraps for a long time. And Grayling, I think, was supposed to keep it under wraps. I can't imagine what's in it. No doubt we're going to find out. But, of course, there's another report that was done when the Lib Dem Conservative coalition was in power into who funds Islamic extremism in Britain. And that's never been released either, because, again, what that probably shows is our good friends, the Saudis, the ones who we got training at Sandhurst and our boys are cooperating with in Yemen. They're the funders of Islamic extremism. But we've got a government report about that, but we're not allowed to see it. I don't know what's in this Russian report. It may be that what's in the report that they don't want to come out is the relationship between various Russian oligarchs and the Tory party. And these Russian oligarchs aren't necessarily pro-Putin. They're just rich. The Tory party gets money from all sorts of people, rich people. Some of them are Russians. That may be what they don't want to come out.
OK, let's just have a look at this guy anyway, Julian Lewis. I hadn't really heard of him before. He's now in the chair of that committee with a very powerful role. If he steps in the wrong direction, he might find himself falling in the River Thames. He's been voting, Martin, for the use of UK military force in combat operations overseas consistently. He consistently voted for the Iraq war. And he generally voted for investigations, though, into the Iraq war afterward. And he wants a replacement for Trident with a new nuclear weapon systems. He's fairly anti-EU, but not totally anti-EU. He is voted against military action against ISIL, which I suppose is a reasonably good sign. But I suppose most Tories anyway would be that kind of voting record, wouldn't they?
Yeah, and of course he's no longer a Tory, because even though this wasn't a whipped matter, he voted for himself to be on.
Yeah, it certainly sounds as if he's going to be a bit more independent mining.
Yeah, and he's obviously safe as far as MI6 and the military are concerned. He's an insider, So we shall see.
Well, look, talking about the military, we have to announce the death of a friend of this programme. We've had on several times. His name is Ian Matteson. He was a major in the British Army before he retired. And in fact, he was brought back, I think, over the Afghanistan, back into the army. He was in the reserves for a while. And the interesting thing about Ian is that he was a Freemason who was very clear about talking about exactly what that meant. And he did an interview with me about 18 months ago about the series that Sky News had done about the Freemasons, which I thought was quite entertaining. He was saying it looked to him as if it had been commissioned and produced by Freemasons themselves, even though it was supposed to be an investigation of the Freemasons. A bit cheeky of Sky to do that. So I thought we'd have a little listen now to a clip of Ian talking about the use of the skull and the crossbones in the ceremonies of the Freemasons, which is, he confirmed it definitely does happen. One of the things I remember him saying to me, Martin, was how bizarre it was to have his own father press a point of a dagger towards his heart, threatening his life when he was first initiated into the Masonic lodge that he took over from his father. He was then later booted out of that lodge. I mean, obviously, this is a cult. It's a religious cult. And to have these sorts of ceremonies does make you think that anybody in public office or in any powerful office at all is much more loyal to their cult than they are to you and I. But let's have a listen to Ian Matteson now.
The skull and crossbones is shown in the third degree ceremony because it's all to do. And there's a sort of a makeshift grave, or in some lodges, there's an actual coffin for the body to be lowered into. That's you, the candidate, the body. And this is to reflect on your mortality. As we say, the story of Hiram Abiff, the chap who's the architect of the, well, actually, it shows, and you enact out the killing of him and then the raising of him afterwards. Back to life. Well, actually, he doesn't come back to life. He raises you up, and from the way he's raised up, are the third degree secrets are then revealed to a master mason. But they're purely parts of mortality, as you and I would see. You've seen skull and crossbones on pirate ships, you've seen skull and crossbones in churches, etc.
Well, hang on a minute, because also the skull and crossbones were on the peaks of the caps of all the SS Nazis in the Second World War. It's also a symbol involved in black magic too. I mean, it does seem as if there is a bit of a negative connotation to this, and yet the Masons seem to embrace it.
Yeah, they want to embrace it, yes, but I mean, one of the things about the Masons is that, I mean, again, go back to the first degree. When you're given your obligation, you're given a what's known as a sign, a token, and a word. And the sign is given, and I don't know if you want to do the gesture, but if you open your right hand and stick your left thumb out at right angles to it, and then draw it across your throat from your left ear to your right ear, and then bring it down to your side, that is the token of a Mason. First degree, although it's always the basic one. And it's symbolic of you having your throat cut across, because that's what you agree should happen to you if you give up the secrets of Freemasonry. The token, as they say, or the handshake, as everybody knows, is a particular one. As in first degree, you'll press the knuckle of the first finger of the other guy's hand, and so on and so forth. And the word, which is a token of word, is taken straight from the Holy Bible. There's nothing, there's no extra words here and there thought up or whatever. They're taken straight out of the Holy Bible, as is the fellow craft is taken the story of the building of King Solomon's temple. And here we are now back within taking stories out of the Holy Bible or the Christian Bible or whatever you want to call it. And yet it's applied to what they've called, and in the program, they says, we are a secular society. Bit of odds there, aren't they?
Yes, well, he's pointing out the hypocrisy, really, in the Sky programme about the Freemasons. But that's lovely to hear the voice of Ian Matteson, who passed away a couple of weeks ago in one of his family, anyway, called suspicious circumstance. He was in very good health and just passed away. Basically, he was out cycling. But Martin, this is actually links up in a weird way, doesn't it, with the stuff we were talking about, we'll be doing a bit more later, about the Phoenicians, because Hiram Abiff was a Phoenician, and it was him that built Solomon's Temple in the first place, and a lot of the Masonic imagery links back to that.
Well, it does in the minds of those who've developed Masonic imagery. I mean, they're obviously they believe in Hermes Trismegistus or whatever it is. Basically, a lot of this stuff is 18th century antiquarianism. And, of course, they believe that they got this stuff originally from ancient Egypt and so on.
The Masons would say 17th century, but if you look at it, people like Elias Ashmole, he admits to have being initiated into a Masonic lodge back in the mid-1600s. So, you know, it goes back a way.
Yeah, it does, but it doesn't go back to ancient Egypt. They didn't know much about ancient Egypt in those days, but they wanted to have an ancient... venerable tradition, but it basically, like a lot of things, it's a created tradition.
You know what?
The tartans in Scotland were an invention of the 19th century.
You're reminding me a bit about the Stonehenge Druids, because I think there's been a sort of reinvention of that. The complete rebuilding of Stonehenge back in the 1920s and the late 1940s. The whole Stonehenge was completely rebuilt. But anyway, look, I think there's just one more story I'd like to look at before we go to some music. And that is that the data, the US and EU privacy shield for data has been struck down by the courts. I will see if I can get an interview with Kevin Cahill about this last week. But today, the courts have said that there will be no more exchange of data by the big tech companies between Britain and America, the transatlantic anymore. So this is a major blow, of course, for the big tech companies. I would imagine, though, that they may have got all their data moved around as much as possible before today. And I would think that there's also going to be compensation to pay for data that has been illegally moved.
Well, it's interesting you should mention that. And it would be interesting to see what Kevin's got to say about it, because the point he was making is that the misuse of data by the tech companies on behalf of the NSA, for example, means that you can't sue the government. There's no possibility. But the tech companies themselves, they can be sued. And you can have something like the payment protection scam, where they all get with the banks, where if everybody sues them for $3,000 apiece for misuse of data, you could possibly bankrupt them.
Well, let's finish on a bit of good news, though. Well, I say finish. We're going to be back after the music. But no DSS letting bans were ruled unlawful this week by the courts. The judges ruled bans on renting properties to people on housing benefit are unlawful. A momentous court ruling, that's a momentous according to the charity Shelter, found a single mum experienced discrimination when a letting agent refused to rent to her. So this actually could make some, particularly for people who go through letting agencies, Martin, make an enormous difference.
It could, but I have to tell you that they've got all kinds of ways of making sure that they don't take people on universal credit. That's been the main cause of the increase in homelessness since it was brought in. Basically, private landlords will not rent to people on universal credit. And one of the biggest private landlords in the country, who's a big Tory party donor, said, we're going to kick out our existing tenants if you bring this in, and we're going to bring in East Europeans who are in work and can pay the rent. So this has always been an issue. It was flagged up to Ian Duncan Smith from the get-go of the universal credit, but he just ignored it. And now we've got a homelessness crisis virtually entirely caused by the government and its regulations.
Thanks to Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Join us in a minute as we take our weekly look around the world. We'll be right back. well, quite appropriately, that was released just before the September the 11th attacks in 2001. That was Orbital, the Doctor Who theme. Welcome back to BCFM's online politics show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Momentous U-turn as Huawei are booted out of the UK by 7 years' time in 2027. We ask a former GCHQ officer in a minute, since they trusted Huawei's equipment themselves, if there's any real security risk, or is this just what we have to do now in Britain? We are part of the US empire, guys. And after Freemason Kemal Atatürk made the Hagia Sophia Cathedral in Istanbul a museum, was one of the seven wonders of the world, Erdogan now turns it into a mosque. What's the reaction of Orthodox Christians? And what's the reason why the Russian Orthodox Church has such strong ties to this particular building? And Professor of Slavic Culture Vladimir Goldstein explains what Erdogan is up to. And following up from last week's bombshell about the Phoenicians from Lebanon, maybe beating Cabo and Columbus to the New World by 3,000 years, this week Lindsay McCauley sailed on last December's epic voyage in a replica Phoenician galley, explains the Mayan pyramids link up to the Egyptian pyramids, and we were just hearing there from Hiram Abiff and Solomon's Temple, which the Phoenicians built around about 1000 BC, the temple that is in Jerusalem. It's the giveaway measurement of the cubit. How did they manage to fly across the Atlantic all the way to the Mayan temples? Was it a little mouth of a little bird? Who knows? Plus, the murder of WPC Yvonne Fletcher by MI6 and the CIA, explained in a Dispatches documentary, and then the whole industry of investigative journalism in London was shut down. A member of the SAS shares more evidence that it was the US, not the Libyans, that killed her in cold blood. But let's start, Martin, with the latest developments in places around the world like Syria and Yemen. Any thoughts about this week's developments? Because I noticed just today, looking at the Israel apparently is hoping to start a war with Iran before the United States elections.
Yeah, well, there's been, as of last week as well, there have been various attacks inside Iran, which everybody's been very cagey about, but it looks as if the Israelis are looking basically to provoke a war, because they need to have a war soon, because they think Trump is more likely to back them than Biden. So that's very dangerous. Lebanon is in free fall, as we discussed last week. That's very dangerous. That could turn into a fight between the Israelis.
Because what the Israelis are basically, their analysis is that the potential of a war in the Middle East is going to be an election issue. And it may be that both of the candidates have to distance themselves from it, and that makes it less likely. So, this is effectively what the Israelis are saying.
Well, the Israelis, I mean, obviously in Trump, they've got somebody that's very much in their camp. Biden is pretty much in their camp. So they've got plenty, you know, they're looking for a showdown with Iran. And of course, Britain will have to do, we are a Rottweiler for the US. We will be expected to join in and support the.
Are the Israelis going to persuade Britain and America to get involved in their war?
Well, they've been pretty successful thus far. We invaded Iraq, as we were talking about in the first hour. Did we need to do that? Not really. That was what they wanted, and that's what we did, with all the consequences.
Anyway, right next door to all of this, of course, is Syria, and that came up at Prime Minister's questions this week. I think it's quite interesting to see how that. Maybe before we hear from that, Martin, what do you make of what's happened there? Because most of it seems to have been forgotten about. Syria kind of never happened, and Assad is still in control, but he's some sort of bad guy. But that's the end of the story.
Well, it isn't. Obviously, what's happened is that the news media have moved on. Instead of cheerleading for an invasion of Syria or military action against Assad, it related to that story is, of course, Shamima Begum has won a court case to allow her to come back to Britain to try and regain her British citizenship. And of course, the tabloid press have been going bonkers about that. But of course, the real story there, as you and I know, Tony, is that she was recruited and groomed to go and fight for ISIS by a Canadian intelligence agent. Because in actual fact, what we were doing, Britain, Canada, the West, is encouraging people to go out there and fight.
He had a personality on Facebook. He groomed her on Facebook. He then met her and went across to Turkey, met her in Istanbul, and then apparently went down on a coach all the way down to southern Turkey and then handed her on to a British agent. The idea is, I mean, you think, well, why would they do this? Well, apparently this Canadian guy had only got his Canadian citizenship because he'd agreed to work for the Canadian intelligence. He was a Middle Eastern chap, and the intelligence services are going around basically offering out passports, British passports, Canadian passports, like confetti, for anyone who will play their games of trying to entrap people into ISIS.
Yeah, and I think that's the main point that the alternative media should be making about that particular case, is that she was groomed by Western intelligence, because Western intelligence set up ISIS along with Saudi Arabia, and we've subjected Syria to 9 years of misery, and that's our fault. We did that. That's what we're responsible for.
I mean, you say our fault. It happened under Labour, didn't it?
When I say our fault, I mean the government of Britain is responsible for that. How much control we've got over that is debatable, but they definitely were doing that. And, then we have all this stuff about how ISIS is a terrible threat and all the rest of it. When we armed and trained them.
Trying to dodge the issue here about David Miliband, because it was under him that the Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister, says that he was brought over to Britain. Miliband was in charge in those days, and I think he thought he was being quite clever, having secret meetings to try and start a civil war in Syria.
Yeah, and you'll notice that he wasn't elected as Labour leader. His brother was selected instead. We know that there's plenty of rot in the Labour Party. There's plenty of rot in the Tory Party. The establishment in this country are terrorists to the core. They've been supporting Islamist terrorism. As we speak now, the Saudi military are at Sandhurst being trained. They're being trained by the RAF. We're supplying them with weaponry. Hundreds of British military personnel are operating in Saudi Arabia as we speak, that great democracy, helping them to destroy Yemen. And, okay. Of course, that's been going on and still goes on.
Well, I think we should go on and talk about that after we've heard about Syria. So let's go to Prime Minister's questions on Wednesday to hear that point made.
Marco Long. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Last week, China and Russia vetoed the United Nations Security Council approving aid to Syria from Turkey. How will the United Kingdom, Mr. Speaker, continue to help those in need in Syria?
Minister.
The United Kingdom is disappointed about the reduction in aid corridors in Syria. We are pleased that the cross-border humanitarian access will continue through Bab al-Hawa, but we are appalled that Russia exercised its veto and restricted aid through Bab al-Salam. The UK remains committed to supporting Syrians who are the victims of the egregious politicisation of humanitarian, and we recently announced $300 million to the Syrian Pledging Conference.
Well, that wasn't Boris, wasn't Prime Minister's questions. I'm not quite sure who that was, a Foreign Office Minister, I imagine. But Martin, he's got a bit of a cheek, hasn't he, saying, oh, we're giving aid. We're not helping the terrorists. We're not helping the Free Syrian Army. We're not helping ISIS. Oh, we're just trying to help the Syrian people through Turkey.
Yeah, and of course, there's still sanctions on Syria. So we're not letting any aid or any help go in through the mainstream channels in Syria. The only aid that we're prepared to allow to go in has to go in through terrorist or freedom fighter controlled areas. Take your pick. And of course, we have armed, trained and directed those so-called freedom fighters, many of them from all over the world, from Uyghurs, from China, lots of Libyans. There's obviously quite a big exchange going on between parts of Libya and Syria. The Turks are facilitating that. And this is all part of NATO policy. And all the crocodile tears about how terrible it is that the terrible regime in Syria has done all these terrible things. We are responsible for wrecking that country. We are directly responsible here in this country. And when are we going to compensate them?
There's been some very big changes in the role of the RAF around the world since World War II. So I thought it'd be interesting to hear this Prime Minister's question about the Royal Air Force and the last surviving member, I think it's of Fighter Command or Bomber Command, who's being honoured at the moment.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. On Friday, the last surviving Battle of Britain aircrew member, Group Captain John Hemingway, turns 101 in the week that marks the 80th anniversary of the start of that pivotal campaign. In contrast with that golden generation, he will not seek any recognition for himself. But we ought to shine a spotlight on the sacrifice of those who defended freedom, and particularly the 1,500 from all commands who fell. Would the Prime Minister give some thought to how we might recognise Group Captain John Hemingway, not for himself, but as the final representative of the few?
I'm Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I thank him for his question. I will indeed think about what we can do. As he knows, these are matters for the Honours Committees, which are independent of government, and I would urge him strongly to make his representations to them.
Well, John Hemingway, Martin, I wonder what he would make of what's going on right now in Saudi Arabia with the bombing of innocent. I mean, the latest is 25 civilians today killed, Yemeni children dying in Saudi attacks. We're using British aircraft and British munitions.
Well, you'd have to ask him, wouldn't you? I don't know what his politics were. You can't guess. But there is a very poignant contrast, isn't there, between the Battle of Britain, where the RAF's defending Britain against attack, and going to Saudi Arabia, that democratic country, as I mentioned earlier, and pulverising the Yemenis, who are the poorest people in the Middle East, and they're now suffering from the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. And not only are we not helping, we are causing it. And yet we all want to come home and have a nice cup of tea.
Yeah, I mean, it's also worth mentioning that the reason that the Blitz happened in the first place, apparently Hitler was, during the early parts of the war, up until sort of 40, 41, 42, was angling to make, well, certainly up until 41, was angling to make deals with the Brits. And he was reluctant to do bombing because he thought, well, if we do start bombing, we're going to be less likely to do deals with the British. But as Karina Urbach said in her book, this is a German journalist, and it was reported in the Daily Mail. I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. It was none other than King Edward VIII, the former King Edward VIII, who met with the German diplomats in Lisbon and persuaded them to start bombing. He was basically saying, well, look, unless you actually start bombing London in the Blitz, then the Brits won't listen to you and they won't negotiate. But if you start to bomb London, then the negotiations can start. So amazing that it was actually a British king, albeit, of course, a German family, the Saxe-Coburg-Gothas, that actually started the Blitz, Martin. Amazing stuff. And, you know, if people don't believe that, then I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to this article. The headline is Edward VIII was a Nazi sympathiser who wanted Britain to be bombed into submission by Hitler, claims this historian.
Well, I'm not at all surprised. And, of course, you could argue that by switching the attack from the RAF's bases to basically civilian targets in towns, they lost the Battle of Britain. So it may well be that that decision was the wrong decision from the German point of view. But anyway, as we know, by the end of the war, we'd incinerated Dresden, and the Americans had incinerated loads of people in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And was acceptable and unacceptable had completely changed.
According to Karina Urbach, Edward VIII blamed the Jews for World War II, and he wanted Germany to emerge victorious from the conflict. He said, effective bombing of England will bring peace to Europe.
Yes, well, it's well known that the Queen Mum, you know, the present Queen's mother, was of that kind of ilk as well. And of course, what subsequently happened, it was all hushed up. Prescott Bush in the United States was very pro-Hitler. And in actual fact, in that era, lots of people of that kind of social group were. And nobody should be surprised about that.
We were here
since the war as well.
we were hearing just the other week about appeasement, and the Russians, Putin particularly, saying that that was a terrible thing to do. So it's a bit difficult, isn't it? I mean, should there? I mean, we could be in this situation again, where we get to the point where war becomes inevitable, and to actually shy away from it means that your people are just going to be subsumed by some evil enemy. Do you think we're reaching that point? Have we reached that point?
Each war is uniquely horrible in its own way, and therefore it's you can't just extrapolate from what might or might not have been a good policy 50 years ago and pursue the same policy. You know, the history is full of contradictory lessons. The First World War was started because people basically just allowed themselves to be led by the nose into something they didn't really understand. I think the situation now isn't like the First World War, and it isn't like the Second World War. It's the Third World War, which is going to be uniquely horrible in its own way.
Well, it'd be interesting to see when that actually, if and when it happens, because a lot of this, Martin, could simply be saber-rattling and making, basically like this thing we're about to talk about with Huawei, it's about trying to make sure that you keep your market more than actually having a fighting war.
Yeah, but I mean, it depends where you live, doesn't it? I mean, the Second World War began long before 1939 in places like Abyssinia or Manchuria or Spain. And in actual fact, that those kind of battles are raging now. If you live in Syria, you've been through 9 years of hell. And as I said earlier, Britain, one of the major culprits. In Yemen, years and years of misery. Britain, one of the major culprits. And, you know, just because there hasn't been a bomb on your street recently doesn't mean that the war hasn't started.
OK, so let's have a listen now to former GCHQ officer Alex Thompson now, because I asked him earlier this week about this decision for Britain to ban Huawei. And I was wondering particularly whether this is just simply a trade decision because of the trade deal that's going on right now between Britain and the United States, that Britain has got to kind of do what it's told. Otherwise, it's not going to get a trade deal with Trump.
I'm Alex Thompson. I report every week for UK Column News on Wednesdays under the brand name of Eastern Approaches. I've lived in the Netherlands now for over a decade as a freelance translator and interpreter most of that time. Before that, I was a GCHQ officer from 2001 to 2009. And shortly after leaving GCHQ to emigrate, I started asking myself more serious questions about the leadership. I must stress the leadership, not the rank and file of the security and intelligence agencies and what their worldview was.
You say an officer, is this almost like a kind of military position? Because most people would associate the word officer with, say, for example, the police or the military.
It is remarkable, Tony. The American intelligence and security agencies all use the term agent, which people are probably familiar with from Hollywood and police series and so on. In Britain, we reserve that term for people who, on a paid basis, inform an intelligence or security agency or a police force. And those who are on the books as staff are known in the British intelligence and security agencies as officers, even though they are not in receipt of a Queen's Commission. It's a civilian job, as in fact, at law, is being a policeman. Of course, the police call their employees, their sworn employees anyway, officers, but they are not. I know it's a courtesy title for constables in the United States, but it's completely wrong and unlawful to call policemen, let alone intelligence agents, officers in the British context. It's just a habit that's developed internally.
Well, obviously, there's quite a lot secret, but can you tell us what can you tell us of what you did do when you were at GCHQ? Because this is a place which has been for many years shrouded in mystery, particularly since the trade unions were removed back in the 1980s under Margaret Thatcher. There was a whole campaign for Thatcher to remove the civil service trade unions from GCHQ in Cheltenham. And give us an idea of the sort of role that GCHQ has and, you know, what you can tell us about what you were doing there.
GCHQ started off as what many people will recognise if I say Bletchley Park, a location near Milton Keynes, although Milton Keynes didn't exist then, it's a new city, in Buckinghamshire. So it's equidistant between Oxford and Cambridge, that location in Bletchley. And during the Second World War, as people will know if they follow encryption stories or thrillers, they will know that the Enigma and other Third Reich and Japanese codes were broken there at Bletchley Park. The formal name of the organization back in those days was GC&CS, the Government Crypt and Cipher School. And these were really pioneer days. There were some absolutely brilliant mathematicians and linguists and computer scientists pioneering the personal computer, well, the precursor of the personal computer, in order to crack very hard cipher during the war. And that tradition has continued. The British continue to be regarded by their partners in the other English-speaking nations as that are part of their Five Eyes Club, the Americans, the Australians, the New Zealanders and the Canadians. The British continue to be regarded as punching above their weight for their skill in these areas, obscure areas. GCHQ is a name that was taken on just after the Second World War. The site moved first to a location in West London and then out to Cheltenham in Gloucestershire, where it's been ever since. And through the Cold War, GCHQ's existence was in some ways even more secret than that of MI5 and MI6. And as you mentioned, Tony, there was a time in the early 80s, 1984, when a staff dispute over the ability, the right as the staff saw it, to join a union led to mass sackings of quite a few GCHQ employees under Mrs. Thatcher. That was reversed under Tony Blair's government, one of his first decisions in 1997 after coming into office. So GCHQ is there to do signals intelligence and information security. Signals intelligence is tracking communications either between people, which is communications intelligence, or communications coming from electronic sources, for example, transponders on vehicles on land, sea and air. That side of the house is called electronic intelligence. Together that makes signals intelligence. There is also, if you like, that's the poacher's role. There's also the gamekeeper's role, which is preventing other nations from doing that to our government and leading corporations. And that is called information security and is managed by a part of GCHQ, which in recent years, under a new branding, the National Cyber Security Centre, has got itself its own office in Westminster, having been in the Cheltenham building for many years. My own role was in translating, transcribing and reporting on political material.
So there is another side to all of this, isn't there? And that is that the surveillance role that GCHQ has can possibly be exchanged with private business, especially when there is a certain amount of encouragement for them to be doing this with from governments. I mean, I've seen certainly the other intelligence services, MI6 and MI5, have been over the years encouraged to share intelligence with big business, effectively to enable those big companies to maybe leverage a bit better around the world if they've got the right information to do so. But this, of course, means that you know, some of the tools that GCHQ can use to access our private personal information could potentially be used for things like data mining. That is to say, getting vast databases to profile literally millions of individuals in Britain and around the world. So what guarantees do we have as members of the public, and particularly MPs, lawyers and journalists, that the ability to use surveillance for legitimate national security reasons is not being abused?
We have very few such guarantees. And the same is true in the other members of the Five Eyes partnership, the other English-speaking countries, and if anyone's listening from the continent of Europe, although that's a civil law tradition, the amount of parliamentary oversight and government supervision is actually just as thin there. The word that you'll hear often in intelligence circles is legality, which strangely is often pluralized to legalities as well, which increasingly I've come to see as not a nod to the law, but a denial of the law, particularly the first principles of law. The idea is that the intelligence and security agencies have had their functions increasingly regulated by statute in a process beginning in the 1980s, certainly getting underway in the 1990s. And then there's been various rounds of European and world level enactments of international law into British statute law, which are supposed to stop the infringement of people's private data and communications for anything but lawful purposes by government itself. But of course, there are exceptions. And if you enact something in a statute, it needs then to be put into practice in a framework document. In the United States model, you would have an act passed by Congress telling NSA, which is the American security equivalent, the American Communications and Intelligence Agency, not to spy beyond certain boundaries. That then has to be implemented by the White House into an executive order. And then, you know, you get the policy decisions. What you mentioned there about companies possibly getting the gist of people's data and communications via the security and intelligence agencies is actually possible. I became dimly aware in my time at GCHQ that certain MI5 officers, for example, spoke in terms of there being what they called an A-list, seemed to be a semi-official term they used, which was a list of companies that were felt to be important enough to Britain, or to UK PLC, as they sometimes said, that they would be in receipt of some kind of slightly sanitized, slightly watered down intelligence. GCHQ's intelligence, at least officially, was not and probably is not shared with companies in that way. But there are ways of disguising the source. The other way that a company can get involved, of course, is through partnerships and becoming a contractor to a security and intelligence agency. NSA in the States, again, has got far more contractors working for it in its headquarters and other locations than government staff. I say far more, certainly more in absolute terms. And these include some very big contractors that in the age of Snowden and WikiLeaks have become well known for that role, such as the MITRE Corporation and Booz Allen Hamilton. And these companies build and hold the data for NSA. And of course, GCHQ fishes from the same data pools. There's also a very under-discussed Israeli angle to all this, which we see popping up in areas such as recently when the National Health Service for Britain, and particularly its data and technical arm, NHSX, started partnering with GCHQ. And who's in the background of that? Matthew Gould, former British ambassador in Tel Aviv. And then we get some very strange links going through to Unit 8200, the Israeli Signals Intelligence Agency, which actually is also active. It does things that would be unlawful and illegal in Britain and America, which is actually fiddled with data while it's not in transit, which would be breaking the terms of the statutory bounds of only looking at communications. So more hacking and shaping views among the public, something the Third Reich also did with its intelligence agency, particularly the Signals Intelligence Bureau did that.
So, I mean, you seem to be hinting here that particularly with the official, I mean, we're talking about the government agencies from Israel, that may be actually more of a Six Eyes than a Five Eyes here.
I've long suspected it, Tony. I don't want to make any assertions I can't back up. There was a time a couple of years ago when, with my colleague David Ellis, who concentrates heavily on European military unification and what's going on there, reporting on that, we did a talk in Devon, which we called the Emergency Briefing, which people can find on the ukcolumn.org site if they go to the European Military Unification landing page of that website. And in my talk, I was starting to hint at that, and I had intended to go on to a second half, teasing it out. But there are hints. If you read the well-known whistleblowers' books, the ones that really got into trouble, like Spycatcher, the well-known book that caused a hoo-ha in the 1980s over its publication, of course, the author of Spycatcher was vehemently denying this. There was a Soviet defector saying the Israelis are the silent partner piggybacking on all this, and you Brits and Americans are spending the money, especially the Americans, and the British providing a lot of brain power together with the Americans, and all of this stuff is just being hoovered up by Israel. And of course, the officers of the time, including the author of that book, did not want to believe it, because names were named. Members of the Rothschild family, for example, who were very good friends to MI5, as the author of that book put it. It has been suggested, but now we're in the post-Maxwell age. The second generation of Maxwell is now becoming a household name for links, allegedly, to Mossad and Unit 8200. It all does seem to be hinting in that direction, but I wouldn't like to pin it just on the project of the political arm of Zionism, the political version of Zionism. It's more to do with corporations than it is to do with the nation state of Israel, I think, the ultimate beneficiary of this massive spy system.
Well, I mean, the other what you've reminded me of here is the very, very important and often forgotten Amdocs scandal in the United States, which was exposed by Carl Cameron on Fox News back in 2001, where he showed that the Israeli mafia were over operating in the United States, and that they were able to use their links to the telecoms companies of the United States in order to observe when taps were put on their phones, so that as soon as a tap was put onto one of the Israeli mafia's phones in the United States by the FBI or another agency in the US, then all of a sudden there would be warnings of those people would then stop their operations, swap their phones, move their bases, locations, and many of them would then return to Israel, and new people would go to take over from them. So this seems quite clear to me, certainly from that report and what you've just said, that there is a great deal of vulnerability to the West's telecoms infrastructure to the Israelis. But look, what we're really here to talk about now is about this enormous, I think, quite a momentous decision, in fact, a U-turn by the British government to say, no, we don't want any Huawei kit in our telecoms system. In fact, it's all got to go. We've got to take the stuff that's there out. Can you just first explain to us, is this, do you think, something that is motivated by national security? Is there really a particular national security risk from using Huawei equipment in our mobile networks?
If there is, and I'm not discounting that there is such a risk, then it's very odd that, as I've mentioned to you before, I think 13 years ago, GCHQ, particularly its information security branch, decided there was no objection to having Huawei UK, which of course is a daughter company of the Huawei in the People's Republic of China that's majority owned by the army, or was at that stage, they decided there was no objection to having Huawei UK being a partner in the consortium to supply the new classified internal telephony service between GCHQ and other parts of the British security apparatus, and with the Americans and other Five Eyes partners as well. And that was duly done, to the great chagrin of some GCHQ officers at the time, who said this is a serious state risk, and they were told to shut up about it. Now, the time that that happened was the ascendancy of, he's been knighted these days, Sir Mark Sedwill, who was a champion of the intelligence agencies at Home Office and Foreign Office level, who eventually became the supremo. He took a new role, created only in 2010 in one of David Cameron's first acts in office. He created this new apparatus, a National Security Council and the National Security Advisor, to be a kind of gatekeeper of what intelligence picture reaches the politicians. And Sedwill has just stepped down as, I think, the third in the series of those new officers. And as his people get cleared out, evidently they've got some enemies now, Dominic Cummings and Sir David Frost being two that I think the Sedwill crowd have got the knives out for. As these people fall, so the decision is reversed. So either there was a security risk then and there still is now, because it's a kind of a fortiori argument. You know, if it's a risk for the general public, then so much the more for the intelligence services to be speaking at top secret level on that equipment or that using that software, I should say. Or there was not. But either way, the timing of the decisions indicates that politics and worldview of a certain clique of securocrats is what's dominant here over really cold technical considerations of security risks. What I've come to increasingly realise, I think, is that in this world of information security, which is a political asset that Britain touts in NATO and on the European continent and even with the Americans, what you've got there is the power of a monopoly of narrative. You can say, trust us, this isn't safe. If you do this, the Russians will hack you or whatever. You're framing the narrative that way. You're effectively cutting certain partners out of the market. And by your recommendations or lack of objections, you're fostering other corporations. It's an inherently political, economic, financial decision to make such recommendations.
Can you just explain a bit more about Cedwill and the kind of faction that's going out with Cedwill, and why is it that there's a change? Is this connected with the Boris government? And in which case, it may obviously be connected with Brexit too. So I wonder if we're looking at you know, a more pro-British nationalist or patriotic bunch coming in rather than a pro-EU, pro-Brussels civil servants.
That is a good way of shorthanding it. I would perhaps say, instead of British nationalist, that the paradigm that the incomers are advocating is Anglo-Saxon cooperation, so English-speaking countries, Commonwealth. It's one of the things we've been hear, the drums that we've heard being banged for a while now. Global Britain is Britain's future after leaving the European Union. That's been a general slogan. Now we're getting a sort of tightening up of it, that Britain will have harder borders. You see it with customs and borders now, although there are obviously laughable leaks in it. The general course of government, certainly since Cummings has come to the fore, seems to be to take a harder analytical look, less fluffy language that the Mark Sedwill crowd used about basically sort of Fabian socialism ideas of brotherhood of man and certainly political and economic unification of the European continent, including Britain. That was that clique's agenda. For sure. The Cummings agenda with Frost replacing Sedwill as National Security Advisor does seem to be much more working in lockstep with the United States. And by that, I don't mean the Trump government necessarily, or the people around him like Steve Bannon, or who have been around him in the past like Steve Bannon, who are thinkers. I'm talking in terms of the established Pentagon and NSA, CIA establishment, who see the world as, you know, the Five Eyes versus the nefarious Eurasian powers. That seems to be coming to the fore again, yes.
Because this Huawei decision is exactly what the United States wanted. They've been lobbying for it, in fact, in quite a bullying fashion for a long time. And of course, they are, one might say, even obsessed with Huawei, having 18 months ago arrested the chief financial officer of Huawei in Canada, and they're now trying to extradite her to the United States. And a lot of people have pointed the finger at this Meng Wanzhou's arrest in Canada as what has precipitated the Chinese now saying, well, okay, so if you're going to extradite Meng Wanzhou from our Huawei person from Canada to the United States, we're going to now start looking at extraditing individuals from Hong Kong into mainland China. And of course, this has kicked off a whole row over there too. So, I mean, aren't we simply just poodles to the Americans, just doing exactly what the Americans want without any real consideration from the advice we've been getting from the security services in Britain?
I wouldn't discount that side of it, but I think that, yes, people who are a particular kind of conscientious observer of the scene, possibly of a left of center tradition and to take a moral view of politics, have long warned Tony Benn, for example, a great among such a tradition, long warned about this. He was a great lover of the Americans himself, of course, but always talked about a particular clique running the American deep state as having Britain really in its grasp and not to the benefit of either nation. There is something of that in it. But if you look further back in history, there has been a much longer and quite determined and extremely secretive tradition coming out of Oxford University and Whitehall from the 1870s, and certainly by the time of the First World War, it had got the upper hand, of steering the Americans and what were then called the Dominions, the English-speaking Commonwealth countries, we'd say now, in a certain direction so that we remained a unified geopolitical force. And you know, the names of some of the bodies that Britain is alleged, or the British deep state is alleged to use in this in America, have become household names among viewers and listeners of the American alternative media scene in the last decade, as a lot more comes out on the internet. Companies like Serco, which began as the Radio Company of America in the 1920s, and bodies in the United States like the Senior Executive Service. There are false or exaggerated claims about what these bodies do. They are not all taking orders from the descendants of Sir Cecil Rhodes, but there is an intellectual element of that in it. And British soft power, as represented, I think, by Sedwell and his ilk, still has this view, even though they're concentrating on unifying Europe, that they have a view that the American muscle is needed. And also the financial clout, because it takes trillions to play in the game of electronic espionage.
What about the move towards confrontation with China, though? Surely this Huawei business is just simply, it's kind of a financial warfare, economic warfare shot across the bows.
When we get to the intentions of the leadership of China as a country, then, you know, that's a very obscure area in which many claims and counterclaims are made. I would think there would be a genuine spectrum of opinion among those who think carefully about China, whether they do genuinely pose an expansionist militarist threat or not. Of course, it's possible to take non-simplistic positions here. It is possible to say, and this has happened in the lead-up to both world wars and other major confrontations in the modern era, it is possible to say correctly that a certain state that's on the rise industrially and in terms of its morale is a threat to the Anglo-American world order, and yet still to misuse that claim in order to use China and I think Russia in many ways as a bogeyman. This happens particularly when we get this dialogue, this discourse of cultural influence and disinformation coming along. So the friends of China in the West, I'm genuinely ambivalent about China as a state towards the West. I think it has much promise and also many hazards to us, but that could be said of many other powerful countries in the world. The friends and advocates of China in the West are quite right, I think, to point out that Britain and America are very hypocritical indeed to take measures and to instigate third countries to take measures against cultural arms like the Confucius Institute at a time when it's very well known that Britain's direct equivalent, the British Council, has been repeatedly accused by Russia of just the same kind of subversion, soft power, turning of minds and light espionage being used through the British Council in countries around Eurasia. So there's a complicated game here. And it's, you know, the main question, of course, to an honest observer is, are we accusing these countries of things that we are doing ourselves or not?
Well, yes. And I wonder also as if it's simply that the US industrialists realize that they cannot compete with Huawei. They've got to find a way to keep Huawei out of European markets.
This reminds me of an interview which has enjoyed a new lease of life recently on YouTube with the late Sir Jimmy Goldsmith, in which just after GATT had become the World Trade Organization, or I think even before that, so in 1994-95 timeframe, he warned in a long, formal sit-down American TV interview in a darkened room that there was going to be a complete loss, a bleeding out of the middle class in America and other industrialized nations, G7 nations, basically, by dint of outsourcing industrial and increasingly intellectual property production from the West to China and India. And it's incontrovertible, whichever way you look at it, that the elite, the economic elite, as well as the security elite of the Western countries, Anglo-American and the continental ones, did decide at this point, I think particularly the Brits and the Americans, to use East Asia and South Asia as their new powerhouse. Now, there may be many nefarious intents there, such as pilfering the intellectual property out of a country to make it less competitive. There are all kinds of valid arguments and analytical lines to take about why this was done. But what is not possible to argue in good faith is that this outsourcing to China was done without the connivance of the people in power at the time.
And there is a third force in a lot of this, and that's Henry Kissinger. He's got lines into the deep state, both in China and in the United States. One does wonder why we heard so little from him. He's basically warned, hasn't he, over the pandemic. Recently, he was saying, well, look, unless we get some sort of much more powerful global order, something that can do what the UN can't do out of this pandemic, then we could be heading for war. In fact, he warns of that directly. I wonder what you think people like Kissinger, who've got fingers in, or should we say feet in both camps, what's their role?
I think ultimately, if you take a cynical view, it is to ensure that any confrontation that develops benefits corporations. Corporations at that level, and some of these very rich bloodlines that span countries and have people in both warring camps, branches of the family in both camps, they think about the outcome of a war before it starts. Kissinger was interestingly warning there about, what Churchill would also call Georgia being better than war, but he kind of inverts it to an idea that war is a threat which is enhanced if the right kind of international dialogue and harmonization isn't happening. Ultimately, what is Kissinger? I mean, people have accused him of being the leader of the Fourth Reich, all kinds of things. It is extremely remarkable that he has remained the doyen of American foreign policy for so many decades into extreme old age. And what is he? Does he represent the survival of a certain kind of German blue blood that wished to see a deal with corporatocratic elements in the West in order to finally, ultimately, to subvert Britain and America as rival economies? There's an element of that to it. There's an element of collusion here with a certain strand of Zionism, which, of course, gets people into very hot water for talking about, but it's been a reality from the 1930s onwards. But we shouldn't ultimately think about countries at that level. Men like Kissinger really see victories for certain systems and corporations, and they like to steer confrontations and possible wars in a direction that will produce a favourable outcome for certain corporations.
So when Henry Kissinger says there may be a war if we don't get the outcome of the pandemic right, is that a threat or a warning, a nice warning or something a little bit more like a threat?
It's, I would say, a veiled threat. You could say there's a softer version of it, perhaps nowhere near as evil, but a slight echo of that is found in this renowned statement by Jack Ma, you know, this fated Chinese entrepreneur of the current day, who says that when trade stops, war starts. Mm. Well, that could be just taken as, you know, homespun wisdom. But I think Mr. Ma, for example, I certainly don't ascribe bad motives to him, but he's foreseeing something else there. He's saying that the special interests in an economy, an advanced economy, the people who have direct lines to policymakers, just will not sit down and accept the loss of certain markets or the continued suboptimal performance of a workforce in a particular country. They will take measures such as flooding a particular economy with a certain kind of immigrant labour or causing the death of the wrong kind of worker and dependent. I think just Jack Ma is aware that this kind of thing goes on and that ultimately certain corporations or their leaders and owners do regard us as cattle. And do see us in terms of a triangle, you know, what a certain, you know, a person in the population produces currency and energy and work, basically. And if those things are not optimized, there's a reshuffle. This is pretty much as near the bone you can get as to analysis of why world wars are engineered, sometimes by corporatist thinkers on both sides of a division before there's a war.
Just get back to Huawei finally. If I've got a router in my house, which is a Huawei router, do I need to be concerned?
There is no way of not being concerned in the internet age about your data. Any device that is wired to the internet, or not wired, but connected in any wireless way, is vulnerable. An often overlooked domain of the vulnerability, well, there's two. One is close access, which is something on your device itself tracking what you're typing and reading. And the other is a secret or backdoor deal with the providers of your software and hardware or your internet service provider or telecoms provider, whereby all your data will be hived off anyway, regardless of who's providing some of the software on the trunk that the communications are going down. It could be taken off a side route and given to your national government signals intelligence agency and then possibly put in a transnational sharing pool. So that there is no way to be entirely assured of your data. But as you were hinting earlier in the interview, it's certainly true. The West, especially the US and Britain, have taken a very lackadaisical approach to national communication infrastructure for decades, while claiming to be the world experts in securing it. We deliberately went away from copper networks, in which Britain probably had the world's best copper network in the 1980s, very hard to tap by comparison. And you could make a call from the Channel Islands to Shetland in perfect quality back then. And you can't do that now at the same ease and cheapness, it seems, in real terms and with the same security. Countries in Eurasia, Russia, China, India, Israel, have taken a much more national security approach to the communication infrastructure. It's almost as if they want their countries to be secure, defensible entities, which I don't think you could say of the people running most of the Western countries.
So if we want privacy, we've got to use paper. Is that the only way?
It's one of the best ways. face-to-face meeting with no electronic devices around is certainly recommendable, but not living in paranoia, that's no solution. If people have a lot of information in the grey zone that's maybe embarrassing to them, but isn't certainly, you know, a big secret, and that they're a bit tentative about talking in case their personal data gets shared, there are strategies other than paranoia to dealing with that situation. For example, wrapping and padding all that you say with a lot of much less interesting blather. That will soon tire out the humans or the artificial intelligence that's trying to look for the needle in the haystack. The more volume you produce and the more inanity you produce, the less interested people it will be in what you're saying.
Well, maybe you should just put all your microphones on and turn the BBC on then, and that will really bore them to tears. Finally, Alex, you know, we're getting such a lot of nonsense from the mainstream press these days. I find myself very annoyed, literally, by the lies, the fake news that we're getting through a lot of mass media and the just complete failure to do any proper analysis or contextualise developments. Can you just give us a couple of hints as to where you think a good place is to go and get, you know, something which is a little bit more reliable to... and maybe thought-provoking when it comes to our daily news?
There are very many excellent sources of alternative news now, just in the English language, and they're coming on in leaps and bounds in other languages too. But for the English-speaking world, obviously I'd recommend our own outlet, ukcolumn.org, which also, for who knows how long, has a YouTube channel, but we are able to do more work if people actually become subscribers and watch through the website. They don't have to donate a great deal in order to do that. UKcolumn.org, there is American Free Press. There is 21st Century Wire, with whom we work very closely at UK Column. And there are one-person operations of extremely high quality, such as James Corbett of the Corbett Report, who is a Canadian reporting from Japan, very smart on a number of long-term investigations. And among websites, I would particularly recommend Consortium News and globalresearch.ca. There are many others. The Wall Will Fall, a very good one, concentrating on Middle Eastern reporting. But once you're into a couple of these, the friends you build up online will point you to others, whether or not you're on social media. And don't go by one or two sources, but go to any source that urges you to look at primary documents for yourself and embeds them in the article, instead of telling you what to think about them, like the BBC and the broadsheets do.
Just to wrap up, this decision about Huawei, am I right? You think that it's more to do with geopolitics than it is about national security?
At that level, geopolitics always trumps national security, because the people who control geopolitics, the clue being in the word geo, meaning world, are not interested in nations, ultimately. They're interested in their own fraternity.
Alex Thompson, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
So, Martin, lots and lots and lots in there. I would just hazard American Free Press, I find, a little bit far right. They have quite a lot of far right stuff in there. But, I mean, obviously, that's totally up for Alex to decide for himself. And they were the inheritors of the Spotlight, which were the only paper in the world reporting properly on the Bilderberg conferences. But anyway, what do you make of what you've just heard? I think, you know, we went all over the place, really, looking at the security, intelligence world, communications, and the real reasons behind the attempt to get rid of Huawei over the next 5-6 years. What did you make of what you've just heard?
Well, it's covering a lot of ground there, so it'd be difficult to pick up on all of it.
Is there anything you'd like to pick out as, you know, interesting points or debate with Alex?
Well, I think it's always interesting to hear from somebody who's been on the inside of a structure like GCHQ. I think that Huawei basically is a political football. You know, when we were friendly with the Chinese and we're all going to be chummy and you know, the world's, you know, George Osborne was seeing China as a definite, you know, Chinese investment in Britain is quite substantial. So if you start, this is what the Chinese ambassador said when they made the decision to get rid of Huawei. He said, well, you can do that, but there are going to be consequences. So, you know, when you're looking for us to fund various things, maybe we're not going to pony up the money. You're looking to get various contracts in China. Well, maybe you're not going to get them. I mean, everything has its price.
Okay, yeah, the other key thing he's talking about there is this whole idea of the six eyes, Israel being the secret. I mean, it's funny the way they use one eye for each country. I thought most countries, if they're like people, have two eyes, but no, it's like the one eye at the top of the pyramid or in the forehead or whatever. You know, it's a little bit spooky imagery, but what about six eyes rather than five?
Well, I think the five eyes is a bit of a mythology anyway. I mean, it's very much part of the pre-internet era when they, you know, the technology was very different from what it is now.
Hang on, Martin. Pre-internet, it was Yakuza. It was the UK-USA agreement, which the other countries were in on. Five eyes is a formal intelligence sharing agreement. He was talking there about a pooled information between the five nations.
Yes, and of course the Israelis are separate, but absolutely integrated in all of it. It's quite possible that they've got complete access to everything the Five Eyes have got access to, even though the Five Eyes don't even know they've got it. He's saying that it's basically corporations that run things. I think corporations do run things, but it's also filtered through perceptions of national interest. The idea that there's a kind of supranational ruling class that has no longer got any interest in the national state, I think that's just wrong. The two things are embedded in each other.
Well,
the success of a corporation often depends upon the support of a government.
Well, that's the way it certainly appears in the West, particularly in the United States and the EU, is that you've got big transnational companies, big banks, seem to actually be more powerful and working much more closely together. I mean, we're talking here actually about people like PricewaterhouseCoopers and KPMG too, more powerful than individual national governments, surely.
Yeah, the national governments in the West serve those private interests that you've identified, and one you haven't identified is the military-industrial complex.
Yeah.
What they don't like about China and Russia is that the balance there is a bit different. The Chinese government is not a liberal government, which is run entirely in the interests of Chinese corporations. The same is true of Putin and his faction, if you like, in Russia. They're known as the Siloviki. They came from the security infrastructure, not from the business side of things. And basically, big business in Russia was put in its place by Putin, which is one of the reasons why the people in the West hate it.
How and when was big business? I mean, I suppose you're talking here about the 1990s days of the oligarchs, the Yeltsin era.
Yeah.
How did Putin put these people in their place?
Well, he hasn't completely put them in their place because that would be a revolutionary thing to do. And what he's tried to do is drag back from. I mean, basically, Khodorkovsky, for example, who Putin put in prison, he was basically, like many oligarchs in Russia, he's of Jewish extraction, he's got Israeli citizenship. He was basically going to give the Israelis the Russian oil industry. And at that point, Putin put his foot down and said, no, you're not doing that. The Russian national interest trumps your private sector deal. And he scotched it. He made sure that the energy industry in Russia remains largely in the public sector. And therefore, all of the profits from it are at the disposal of the Russian government. But don't forget, if Yeltsin and his backers in the West had had his way, all of the oil in Russia would now belong to Western multinationals, and all the profit would be just being sloshed back into the city of London and Wall Street. He put a stop to that, which is what's caused a lot of the grief and a lot of the anger, because everybody in the West who at first thought that he was going to play ball, but he didn't. And the Chinese, of course, have opened their economy up. That's what they were asked to do. They've done it. But they haven't privatized everything. The commanding heights of the economy in China, including the banks, remain in the hands of the government. This is basically denying the Western way of doing things, which is why we can't get on with them, because they won't accept our way of doing things, in which the corporations are basically the bosses and the governments are the servants.
I mean, that surely is the ultimate capitalism. It's when the banks basically buy up anything that opposes them.
Well, capitalism as a theory is to do with free markets and consumer choice. But real capitalism has always been about the interaction between entrepreneurs and technology and governments. governments are absolutely important. The government spending is one of the most important sources of private profit in any country. And if you can get government contracts, that's a far easier way to make money than inventing a better widget.
As we sort of edge towards this further tension with China, one of the key areas, of course, is the Middle East. The Chinese have made it absolutely clear they want the Palestinians to have East Jerusalem as their capital. They're really saying, aren't they, Martin, that all the stuff that was achieved by the Israelis in the Six-Day War and in the October War in 1974, which triggered the massive oil shortage around the world, that all that is gone. And actually, what you need to do is get back to the original UN agreement with the Palestinians and Arabs in East Jerusalem and using that as their capital. This is quite this for the Israelis and the Americans is like a red rag to a bull, and maybe for some British too. But one of the key countries in the area is Turkey. Turkey is sort of torn between Russia and NATO. And it was very interesting this week to see the Hagia Sophia Cathedral, a cathedral built many, many, many years, but in fact, I think it was 800 or 600 AD, one of the seven wonders of the world, changing from being a museum, which it's been for many years, rather than going back to becoming a cathedral, an Orthodox Christian place, a Muslim place instead. And I was scratching my head, is this a good thing or is this not a bad thing? But I thought I'd have a chat to someone that goes there fairly regularly, even though he's based in the United States. It's Vladimir Goldstein, and he's a lecturer in Slavic studies at one of the big American universities. So let's have a listen to his take now on this big change by Erdogan. What's he up to?
It was built in the 6th century by Constantinople Emperor Justinian, and he already at that time, he was very ambitious. So he knew what he was doing. So he invested, hired top-notch architects, Isidore and Artemius, and asked them to build something which, as he put it, would put Solomon in his temple to shame. So it was like a clear desire to put sort of all religion, Judaism, to shame, because we are now the new kids on the block, we're Christians, we're the greatest, we're the best. That's what he wanted to do. And he built this absolutely amazing structure, which was, was like a wonder, of the world at that time, 6th, 7th century. Just to give you a sense of how kind of, huge it was and how must have impressed people, first, like in terms of the size and number, and then a description of it. So in the year of 612, its staff consisted of 80 priests, 150 deacons, 40 deaconesses, 160 readers, 25 cantors or singers, and 100 doorkeepers. 100 doorkeepers. So it was a place where just, the whole Constantinople would go and pray and, among other things, admire and adore, because it was absolutely beautifully decorated. Here's this Byzantine historian Procopius in his book on buildings. He writes about Hagia Sophia, and that's what he writes. It's best in sunlight and the reflection of sun rays. One might almost say that it is not illuminated from without by the sun, but from the radiance originated from within. Upon the central circle rises a sort of huge spherical dome, incomparable, beautiful structure. So it's an impression, when you enter to pray, your mind is lifted up and as if you feel as if you walk in heaven.
Well, it sounds to me, not surprising, it was one of the wonders of the world in those days, 6th century, this would have been extraordinary. People would have looked at that and say, well, how does that dome stay up there?
Absolutely. And it was, so I think it was a pride of this eastern part of Christianity. And then, of course, we have emerging of kind of sort of Russian lands. At that time in the 10th century, they have this Kievan Prince Vladimir, and the previous religion of Slavs, they were kind of pagans. They have their like all pagan pantheon, not dissimilar to the Scandinavians, not dissimilar to other ones. But for various reasons, historians will argue there was politics. I'm sure there was this and that. So Prince Vladimir decided to baptize Russia. You know, obviously there was a lot of political reasons, you know, like in today's world, alliances, marriages, money, whatever was involved.
But this was quite big, wasn't it? I mean, it was almost like Constantine in the Roman Empire. Absolutely. He suddenly decided to change things, didn't he? So absolutely. This similar sort of thing happened in Russia too.
Yeah, absolutely. So, but what is important, according to sort of all these historical documents, like primary chronicles, the way Russians will tell their story of their conversion. So, of course, there might be like conversion has political, social, economic reasons, but also the myths, the stories which people tell. And the story, according to this chronicle, is very telling. So this Prince Vladimir cannot choose. He's, you know, Muslims try to impress him, Western Christians try to impress him, and Constantinople try to impress him. So first, it is fascinating, he rejects the Muslims, saying the drinking is the joy of Russia. We cannot live without this pleasure. So it's very so funny that already in the 12th century, that was one of the joys of Russia. Then, you know, he sends envoys to the Western lands, and they come back and say, we have reports from Hagia Sophia, and they were mesmerized. They were totally mesmerized, and they said, we've never seen such a beauty, the way they were describing it, for you know, we didn't know where we were in heaven or on earth when we were there. For on earth, there is no such splendor or such beauty, and we're at the loss of how to describe it. So this is kind of totally transformative experience. We only know that God dwells there among men, and their service is fairer than the ceremonies of other nations. We cannot forget this beauty. So it's very interesting, sort of A, conversion, but B, conversion in a particular way, conversion sort of by the beauty. And this kind of remains within Russian Orthodoxy, remains with Russian culture, which continues to respect kind of, you know, artistic expression, beautiful expression. And I think so Russians are very much vested in the whole kind of, you know, edifice. So, but what is interesting that for Orthodoxy, the beauty of the place is important. So just if we move to the present, as you said, turning into the mosque, you know, and we you know, we should respect all the religions and all their manifestations, but, you know, mosque does like the images. So basically, they will cover the beautiful, you know, kind of mosaics. So it wouldn't be the same kind of effect, at least for the visitors. When you preserve it as a museum, visitors can see it. Visitors can admire it. You know, they still would admire the structure from outside, say, but they wouldn't have this kind of sense of drench in sunlight and so on. So
yeah, but can you see how some Christians, particularly Orthodox Christians, might say, well, actually, this is not on. You know, this is usurping a Christian church, which was built by Christians for Christians and the Muslim faith. And I also understand that, for example, some of the frescoes, the Christian frescoes, are going to be covered up now.
Yeah, I mean, it's very frustrating. Of course, you know, many people, you know, there are a lot of arguments, you know, to A, people understand that this is like Turkey. It's on their territory. It's kind of ultimately it's their decision. But, you know, we know that UNESCO recognizes tremendous amount of, you know, world heritage places. And what is surprising is that it's, you know, it found kind of some kind of, you know, middle ground. It was a museum. Of course, there were like minarets. It. Of course, there was a certain kind of, you know, on the, you know, probably quotations from Quran. But, you know, the rest of the stuff was preserved. And, you know, I've been there actually, last time I've been there was this October. And you can imagine people from all over the world. This is just the place to admire and, you know, to be moved and, you know, to contemplate. And I think it's probably that's how she should have stayed for some reason.
Do you think it's being used a bit of as a geopolitical pawn here? That the you know, it's a beautiful building, but maybe Erdogan is saying, well, you know, the West is waging this war on Islam, you know, in Afghanistan and various other places. Certainly in Iran, you know, they really don't like the Iranians. He's in a way sending a message out to the world that you know, Islam is very welcome in modern Turkey.
I think, you know, my feeling is that his, you know, basically politics, every politics is driven by economics. So I think it's primarily he's trying to decide internal issues. You know, there are certain economies not doing very well, like in most of the world. People might be disappointed in him. And so he tries to reinvent himself as some kind of a defender of Islam, as defender of this kind of great tradition. But he's driven, I suspect, by internal politics to begin with, but also by external, because he now feels that, for example, you know, whether for better or for worse, the main defender, say, of orthodoxy is Russia. Russia is not standing very well in the West. You know, there is always accusations of Russia by United States, by NATO countries, but United Kingdom. So he probably feels that weak spot, and, you know, maybe under different circumstances, he could have maybe thought about it. But I guess when he put it all in the balance, winning some points domestically, winning some points within, you know, Islam wall, and whatever he would lose, he also kind of probably have a feeling that he can buy off Russia, because he's still very much interested in trading in Russia. So he, on the balance, he thinks that he will win, but he is definitely is going to lose the hearts and minds of endless amount of Orthodox and probably other Christians. You know, I know the Catholics are very much kind of upset about it. So I think he might, in the long run, I think it's a very kind of myopic decision on his part.
So that's Vladimir Goldstein there. Martin, he's basically saying, it boils down to, this is just a kind of decision to try and bolster Erdogan's domestic support amongst Muslims, showing, I suppose, the idea really starting to turn around some of the secularization of the country by Ataturk.
Pretty much can't disagree with that. He's got elections coming up. His base are disappointed for various reasons, as a contributor pointed out. And he's been threatening to do this for years, and by doing it now, he's cashing that card in terms of trying to win elections inside Turkey. And of course, there's an ongoing struggle between the secularism of the state, as originally conceived by Ataturk, and the basically pro-Sunni Islam Muslim Brotherhood politics of Erdogan.
Okay, so let's move on and have a little look now, our penultimate item, at what we were doing last week, partially, which is the Phoenicians. And one of the people who was on the trip with Philip Beale across the Atlantic at the end of last year in this replica Phoenician vessel goes by the name of Lindsay McCauley, and he's an Australian. He's come up with a theory, actually, after having a holiday over in Mexico, and he has been proving it. His book is just coming out very soon. We can talk about that when we've heard from him, about the way that he has discovered that the cubit, as a unit of measurement, it occurs in the building of the Mayan pyramid, as well as the building of the Egyptian pyramids and in Solomon's temple. So this is another very strong indication that those Phoenicians, 2000 BC, even that early, potentially, certainly by 1000 BC, were flitting backwards and forwards across the Atlantic like Philip was and Lindsay was last year. So let's hear a little bit from Lindsay McCauley about the amazing Mayan pyramid and the use of cubits.
A cubit's about the length from your elbow to your fingertips, and it was used as a measurement 3,000 years ago. There's a few varying lengths on the cubit, but one that came out to the front is the royal cubit, and that was used on Solomon's temple, and that was built by the Phoenicians. That's well documented, that the cubit was used on the Solomon's temple. That's the common link between ancient Israel, Egypt, and the temple of Kukulkan is the cubit. It's a very accurate representation of that measurement, and it's reflected in the calendar lengths used by the Mayans. So there's pretty strong evidence that something went on about probably 1,000 to 2,000 years ago that people actually came across the Atlantic. They met with the Mayans. It's a different history to the Spanish. When the Spanish came across, they conquered. The people that came across and worked with the Mayans 2,000 years ago actually collaborated, and they brought their knowledge and they integrated their knowledge. It was a collaborative thing that went on there, and they built this temple using each other's knowledge. the evidence is quite strong with that regard, and it throws a different light on that, on well, who discovered America, or the history of America.
So that's Lindsay McCauley there. His book, Decoding the Lost World of the Maya, A Personal Odyssey by Lindsay McCauley, is just coming out in the next couple of weeks with an amazing picture of the prow of a Phoenician vessel with a great horse, which is the way that they used to embellish the boats that they built, the Phoenicians. Martin, you know, again, isn't it interesting that the same system of measurements was used on these Mayan pyramids? It does, again, it adds even more than what we were hearing last week to evidence that there was some sort of cultural exchange going on across the Atlantic.
Well, I have to say, none of that is accepted in mainstream academia. That doesn't mean it's wrong. I'm just saying that that's the case. And if you think about it, the cubit, which is a measurement from your elbow to your fingers, that's a pretty natural thing for anybody to use if you're building stuff. Okay, you don't really need somebody to tell you to do it, do you?
Just explain, because what he's discovered is that, yes, you're right, of course, that this was a standard way of measuring things around the world, but a cubit would be different in one part of the world to another part of the world. What he's discovered is that these are exactly the same length as the cubits in the building of Solomon's Temple and of the Egyptian pyramids.
Well, when he mentioned Solomon's Temple, Solomon's Temple was destroyed. So whatever's left of it, if it ever existed, there's even disputes about whether it existed amongst archaeologists. It's buried somewhere under the Temple Mount. So saying that they used this, that, or the other doesn't mean anything, because nobody's ever seen Solomon's Temple.
Yeah, but
Martin, the
Egyptian pyramids exist, don't they?
Yes, they do. And but the Mayan pyramids are quite different. And I've got no particular axe to grind here. He's trying to sell a book, and people like. they like discussing this kind of topic. I read an awful lot of archaeology books, and of course there is a mainstream view about this. At one stage, everybody thought that any new idea had to be a diffused idea. So somebody first of all thought about how to make iron weapons, and then everybody else copied them. But it's increasingly clear. I mean, the tendency now in modern archaeology is to see that most things that develop there's no reason why people in South America shouldn't have developed high-level civilizations without any outside input at all. They just have their own minds, which are the same as our minds. Homo sapiens' mental capacities haven't changed much in hundreds of thousands of years. And that means that, you know, your average Mayan is as brainy as your average modern, and therefore quite capable of inventing anything that they could invent. Of course, people do copy other people's ideas. But I come back to what we mentioned last week. When the Columbian Exchange took place, and I've just read a book about that, loads of people died because they were not they didn't have antibodies against diseases that had developed from mixing with farm animals in Eurasia. Now, if there had been earlier contacts, and thus earlier contacts have been in any way significant, you would have expected the Phoenicians to have taken over smallpox, influenza, etc. And that now it's possible that they did, and that there was a previous exchange of microorganisms. But it doesn't seem likely. And I think that the Vikings clearly did make short-lived settlement in Newfoundland. But they didn't have enough interaction with the locals to pass on the diseases. Now, that seems to me fairly conclusive.
Yeah.
If you don't pass on the diseases, then you haven't linked up with them.
Martin, those Viking ships were modelled on the Phoenician ships as well. Anyway, let's round off tonight by...
Well, they were built in a completely different way, but it doesn't matter.
Let's round off... Well, a lot of people said that there's an enormous... Well,
they're both ships. They're both wooden ships, but Viking ships are clinker built. Phoenician ships were built on a frame, so it's a different. It's two different kinds of ships. Viking ships were unique.
So it's just all I'm doing is I'm reporting what a lot of archaeologists have said, that there's a good deal of influence from Phoenician boats in the design of Viking ships. Now, anyway,
well, I don't accept that, but never mind. It's not worth arguing about.
Let's have a look at a bit more recent archaeology now, and the murder of PC Yvonne Fletcher in something you'll probably be more enamoured with, Martin, actually, which is the 17th of April 1984, when she was murdered in St James's Square in London, and murder was blamed on the Libyans. It's become pretty clear for anyone that bothers to look at this, particularly at this dispatches programme, and that it was actually, she was murdered by us, not by the Libyans, and it seems pretty horrific that you can get intelligence servicing murdering police officers, Martin. Why would they be able to get away with that?
Well, because they've done it before in the Gladio era in Italy. They murdered police officers. It's part of creating fear. And, you know, the political goal in this particular case was absolutely clear. The British had quite good relations with Gaddafi, and they were trying to do business with him in things like oil and so on. The American deep state weren't happy about that. Margaret Thatcher didn't seem to want to go down the road they wanted to go down, which was sanctions on Libya. So they arranged for a British, a 19-year-old British police officer to be killed, so that Thatcher would then fall into line with sanctions on Libya, which she duly did. And, of course, this has been in the news recently because they won't prosecute the guy they said did it because he didn't do it, as was discussed in those dispatches programmes all those years ago.
So, 12 years after Yvonne Fletcher's death, there was this two-part dispatches, Murder in St James, which was broadcast in 1996, made by Fulcrum Films. And bizarrely, I was trying to contact on Twitter a couple of the people, the producer and the reporter involved, on the Twitter Messenger service. Went back to Twitter yesterday, Martin, and you won't believe it, those messages have just disappeared into thin air. How about that? But let's have a listen now to Steve Devereaux. He's a former SAS, operative. Member of the SAS, soldier, and see what he had to say about the operation where the SAS had been preparing for 10 days to storm the embassy.
The public expectation was that the SAS would storm the building and kill the occupants, just like the Iranian embassy siege 4 years earlier. One of the SAS soldiers called to the square was Steve Devereaux.
My main entry point was up here, the top right-hand window. You just about see it above the parapet. That was the first entry point. I would have run across the roof, placed the explosive charge on the particular window, blown the window, and then we would have assaulted through the window, four of us. And somebody throwing flashbangs, creating noise and havoc, taking out any targets that were in there. We would have had MP5s. Two of us would have had shotguns, sawn-off shotguns, and pistols.
Would you have expected that some of the Libyans would have had to be killed in this process?
If they were armed, yes.
Were you disappointed when you were stood there?
Absolutely right, yes. We'd psyched ourselves up for almost 10 days, 2 weeks, and to be told that we weren't going to storm it, you know, that, it really wasn't, it pissed a lot of people off.
There's no doubt in your mind that you would have been able to successfully storm that embassy in the way that the Iranian embassy was stormed?
No problem. Absolutely no problem at all. And we would have done a bloody good job as well.
Instead, the diplomats were sent home. In public, Gaddafi gave them a hero's welcome, but in private, he was fighting for survival. 10 days after their return, he faced a major coup in which members of Al-Bakan took part. The French Secret Service and the CIA passed on satellite photographs and communications intercepts, but the rebellion failed after a street battle with the Libyan army. Ultimately, though, the killing of Yvonne Fletcher still served its purpose. 2 years later, American bombers flew from Britain to attack Libya. Other European states refused to let the bombers fly over their territory, and Margaret Thatcher was also reluctant to get involved. But she was swayed by just two words, Yvonne Fletcher.
So that was a clip from the Dispatches documentary, Murder in St. James, from 1996, Martin. Now, look, I mean, amazing how such an incident as murdering a police officer the CIA, it seems, being involved in that, most definitely. I don't know if the British security services would have done it as well. Can be used as an excuse, basically, for a regime change.
Yeah, but I mean, people who are regular listeners to this show will know that what you see in the mainstream media is what you see in the mainstream media. And the reality of what goes on behind the scenes is what it is. And that the murder of, you know, it's quite cynical, really. They chose her because she was young, photogenic, and it would definitely get the desired effect. And of course, the Libyans inside the embassy were armed. They opened fire on people on the other side of the road who were protesting against them, shooting over their heads. And when they knew the Libyans were going to do that because they got bugs inside the embassy. And while the Libyans were doing their fighting, shooting over their heads, a completely different bullet was used. It was the same caliber as the bullet as the Libyans were using, but it came from a completely different direction. And the second part of the dispatches program showed how they brought the weapon in from Germany, which had been bought on the black market. Now, this is the way the world works, folks. 9/11 attack wasn't carried out by people in Afghanistan. WCC Fletcher wasn't killed by the Libyans. The Lockerbie bombing wasn't carried out by the Libyans. There's all sorts of stuff like this, and it's easy to get lost in it all. But obviously what really matters in the end is the facts. That's what matters.
Well, that's what, and that's what we're digging out here. I mean, what it does do, from imagine the situation in 1984, you've got all these SAS preparing to storm the embassy. Somebody somewhere says, look, we've done this with the Iranians already. It might not look good. Let's kill a police officer instead. Maybe that's the way to do it.
Well, no, I think they planned to kill a police officer in the first place. The talk of storming the embassy was just talk. And, of course, when they stormed the Iranian embassy, the people that went into the Iranian embassy was what is now called MEK. MEK are Islamist Marxist terrorists who are opposed to the Iranian government. So they were the ones, and, of course, they're now our allies. In those days, they shouldn't have, you know, they treated them as enemies of Britain because they did what they did on British soil. But of course, we were quite hostile to the Iranian regime, and we were quite friendly to MEK, as we still are. And of course, they carry out all sorts of attacks inside Iran all the time. That's why that's your taxes at work, folks.
What about the situation in Libya now, Martin? It's all rather falling apart. Got Khalifa Haftar and an official government, apparently, as well.
Well, it's a terrible mess.
So two governments, effectively, with a whole load of
there's two ostensible governments, and there's also loads of just lawless people. You know, it's basically broken. It's become very similar to Iraq, and of course it's a very very dangerous. It's closer than Iraq. We've had all of these refugees pouring out of Libya since we liberated it, and of course. There was no real evidence that Gaddafi was going to use aircraft on demonstrators. That was rubbish. But on the back of that, the resolution that was passed in the UN Security Council, the Russians and the Chinese, and they now regret this, they abstained on the no-fly zone over Libya. Because what they presumed was that the West would put in a no-fly zone to prevent Gaddafi using aircraft, but then that would lead to a political solution. But, of course, they were double-crossed by the West. The West basically used the RAF. They killed thousands of people, and just like we're doing in Yemen. And, of course, Gaddafi was overthrown, had a bayonet stuck up his bum by the insurgents and a bullet through the head. And that was job done. But, of course, it wasn't job done for Libya, because Libya, which used to have the highest standard of living in Africa, is now a basket case. Black Libyans and black Africans have been ethnically cleansed and killed. And there's now a face-off going on between the one lot of countries, Egypt and Saudi Arabia. France is on that side as well, are backing Haftar. And, of course, Turkey are backing the other lot. And there's a potential for a war in Libya between the Egyptians and the Turks. And, of course, there could be a war between Turkey and Greece, or you know, the potential for fighting all over the world is probably as high as it's ever been, and we're only not recognizing that because of A, the COVID crisis, and B, the economic crisis that's on the back of the COVID crisis.
Well, I mean,
but in many ways, we're in a geopolitical crisis.
Yeah, I mean,
this is an inflection point.
It does. I mean, it does seem to me as if, you know, you've got this failed attack on Syria, which was an attempt at regime change there. That's failed. And that the COVID and the exaggeration of the COVID is a kind of manifestation of the deep state's frustration with not being able to achieve what it wanted to in Syria. So turning its guns on its domestic population, trying to subdue them instead.
Well, it may be, as I say, the COVID could be a natural phenomenon or it could be a deliberate attack. But either way, what it's doing is bringing everything to a head. We're going to have to face up to all of these problems simultaneously. So we're going to have both medical, military and economic problems all wrapped up in one big improvised explosive device. And okay. goodness knows what's going to come out of that.
Back to Yvonne Fletcher and the Foreign Secretary and the Defence Secretary would be two key ministers who would have almost certainly have been in the loop if something like that was to have happened.
Oh, well, you can't presume that.
Well, no, I'm saying almost certainly. I'm not presuming it. I'm saying almost certainly in the loop. The reason for that is because if it was discovered that something had happened that they hadn't been previously signed off, then they could potentially go ballistic. And so you can't do that. But anyway, one of them, the Foreign Secretary, was Sir Geoffrey Howe. He's dead now. He died in 2015. But the Defence Secretary at the time, who is likely, I would attest, to have given the nod to something like the murder of Yvonne Fletcher, is Michael Heseltine. He was Defence Secretary.
Yeah, but the way I see these things working is that what happens is that they don't ask questions about things that they don't need to know about, and therefore they don't know about. They need plausible deniability. You don't run everything past the political leadership. And if you remember what happened when Dave Shaler and Annie Machon went to Robin Cook, because he was the Foreign Secretary at the time, and said, look, MI6 are engaged in trying to assassinate Gaddafi, the MI6 certainly hadn't told Robin Cook what they were doing. And generally, they won't unless they want to. The deep state is just that. It's deep. That's the whole point about it. And in fact, probably many of the people who are the most powerful in it, nobody even knows who they are. And the politicians are basically very low level. They're only included when it's necessary. And well, basically, they're only told what they need to know.
See if we can get an interview with Michael Heseltine and put that to him. It'd be very interesting to see what his reply was. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, that is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. You can download our MP3s and listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, comment page and our contact details at thisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Tune in on Sunday evenings at 6 on BCFM 93.2 with Danny Loch. And BCFM's boss, Pat Hart, did say that our sister show, Dialect, would be on BCFM Monday at 10. So far, it hasn't been at all. We hope to be on a new FM channel soon. Do please join us for the Politics Show live stream, 5 o'clock every Friday. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.